Commissioner Heinicke?
Here.
Commissioner Khan?
Here.
Commissioner Lee Fei Wu?
Here.
Commissioner Lee Harry?
Here.
I mean, Larry. Sorry about that. Commissioner Norman?
Here.
Commissioner Patton? And Commissioner Sokot?
Here.
We have a quorum.
Thank you. It's my understanding that Commissioner Patton is on the way, but will be slightly late tonight. We'll let you guys know that I have my cell phone here. My wife was due to have a baby on Sunday. The baby is doing the smart thing and staying in the nice warm place where she is. But if this phone goes off, I will have to turn things over. I believe, Vernon, you've agreed to stay the whole night. Thank you very much. Okay. This meeting has been called to order. Before we begin, I know we have a long agenda on our intersex public hearing. As several commissioners have pointed out, Commissioners Khan and Grigg in particular, this last few weeks has been a tough time for the city. There's been a sort of an outbreak, for lack of a better word, of violence, and we thought it appropriate to just mark this with a moment of silence in memory of the people who lost their lives, who, of course, include police officer Dennis Espinoza and others. So if you'd join us just in a brief moment of silence in memory of the people who've lost their lives here in the city. Thank you very much. I will call now under the Sunshine Rules for public comment on items not on the agenda. This is not for public comment on items that are on the agenda. There is a space for that. Okay, seeing no public comment on items not on the agenda, it is my understanding that we will dispense with the director's report and the chair report this evening. Director Harmon, is that all right with you?
Absolutely.
Okay. Let's get on to the first and major agenda item tonight, which is the intersex public hearing. Let me just say, as the chair of the commission, my name is Malcolm Heinicke. You can call me Malcolm. You can call me Commissioner Heinicke. You can call me lots of things. Welcome to everybody. We appreciate your input. It's been suggested to me personally and to all of us as a commission that we are appreciated for holding this hearing. Let me just suggest back that we appreciate the opportunity to be educated on an issue that is important to a great many people, on an issue that maybe hasn't received the sort of government attention it should, and we're looking forward to an education tonight. Let me just note, in addition to our director, Virginia Harmon, here tonight is Anna Damiani from Assemblyman Leno's office. Anna, where are you? Very good. If you'd like to come forward and make some introductory remarks on behalf of the Assemblyman, we'd appreciate that.
Good evening, Chairman Heinicke, commissioners. I wanted to start off on behalf of the Assemblyman of saying that he is sorry that he couldn't be here this evening. However, he is in Sacramento, and things are a little difficult up there right now. So they're working really hard to try to help things in San Francisco and for the state of California. But I wanted to first begin by commending the commission. Their history of work on LGBT issues has been amazing in San Francisco, and you've made great strides. And in taking this step today, bringing in and starting to have serious discussions about intersex issues is a huge first step. It is a first step, and there's definitely a long way to go, and I'm sure we'll hear a lot about that as the hearing goes on. But we wanted to express our thanks for taking this time and making, you know, airing the issues. And then we look forward to seeing what comes out, what issues are raised, and working closely to see how we can help resolve the issues that come up. So thank you very much, and I look forward to hearing what comes up. Have a good evening.
Thank you, Anna. We appreciate your effort. At this point, let me make an introduction and some thank yous. One of the things that we have at the Human Rights Commission that we really appreciate is a fantastic staff. The LGBT Advisory Committee, which is headed at the staff level by Larry Brinken and Cynthia Goldstein, sort of have overseen the intersex task force that we've put together. This committee is now chaired by Commissioner Norman. to my left here, and was formerly chaired by Commissioner Sparks, now a member of the Police Commission. She is not here, but she's sort of here in spirit, and my thanks definitely go to her as well as to Larry and Cynthia. On the Intersex Task Force, I think it's important to note that a former staff member, former intern, Ben Lunine, is here, and, I think this issue was first raised to me personally by you, and I remember we had a very sort of meaningful discussion at Pride Day, and I know that you have played a very important role in bringing this here, so I'm very glad that you're here. And then, of course, the driving force behind this at the staff level has been Marcus Arana, who is sitting right here. And on my outline, Marcus, I see that you are first up for sort of an introduction, so I will turn it over to you, which is something I'll probably say quite a bit tonight.
Commissioner Heineke, Commissioners, Director Harmon, thank you very much for starting us off on this momentous occasion this evening with the intersex hearing. And very much I want to express gratitude to the members of the LGBTAC and the community members who worked on the intersex task force for quite some time to make this a reality. So I want to give you a little bit of background and a summary of what has brought us to this place of having this hearing. And it began with the Human Rights Commission being approached by people with intersex anatomies who expressed deep concerns. And they presented information at a panel at the LGBTAC last year. As a result of that, the task force was created by the LGBTAC in May of last year and worked to create a presentation that was done on September 11th of 2003 to this commission. And that was the project that Ben Lunine worked on that Commissioner Heineke referred to. Finally, the hearing was approved by this commission in January 2004. So why is this coming out of the LGBT Advisory Committee? It needs to be stated right now that this is not the same as lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender concerns, although some people with intersex anatomies are lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender. But I really want you to separate it out and think of it as a different issue, and as we go along and look over the information, I think those differences will become apparent to you. Some of the fears that were expressed to us by these individuals were that doctors were doing sexual assignment on infants born with so-called ambiguous genitals, and that there was a fear of homosexuality, that sexual assignment was done to reinforce heterosexuality, that it was done to reinforce a paradigm of male-female bipolar sexuality. And it was being done, according to the allegations, with the assumptions of what a child's actual gender identity is before this child is able to express that gender identity. So these are some of the issues and questions before us. We are going to hear from people with intersex anatomies. We're going to hear from parents, doctors, medical providers, educators, and psychologists. Doctors have submitted testimony from Oakland, Stanford, Hawaii, San Francisco, New York, Oregon, and Michigan. People with intersex anatomies and their parents have sent in written testimony from Argentina, New Zealand, Germany, Switzerland, Africa, as well as Florida, Oregon, Washington, D.C., Chicago, Washington State, Los Angeles, the East Bay, and San Francisco. It's a lot of testimony to have come through our office regarding this issue. Many people could not attend because of time, because of prior commitments, and for some, geographical distance was too great. And for others, the cost of attending was too emotionally costly. So some of their testimonies may be read into the record by different community members. What will happen after the hearing? All of the oral and written testimony sent into the commission by June 25th, 2004, will be considered in the drafting of a report of this hearing. That will include findings and recommendations. Then we will return to the commission, hopefully in August, that's our projected timeline, with a draft of the report for your approval at that time. In closing, I want to say that The prevalence of intersex births seem to be very high. The estimates range from 1 in 150 to 1 in 2,000 births. According to the film, Is It a Boy or a Girl?, 65,000 people with intersex anatomies are born every year worldwide, and 5 surgeries are performed every day in the United States. According to UCSF, 40 surgeries are performed every year in San Francisco. This hearing is unique. It has never been done by a governmental entity in the U.S. and has never been addressed from a civil rights issue perspective before now. There are going to be many different points of view, and many will be divergent. So it's crucial that we all conduct ourselves with dignity and mutual respect, even where we may strongly disagree. And if we can all approach this very emotional and very complex subject with open hearts and open minds, we will learn a great deal today. The task force will be diligent over the next few months drafting a report that will reflect the work that we do today.
Thank you, Marcus. Just to reiterate one thing that Marcus says, which probably doesn't need to be said, but the Human Rights Commission and our jurisdiction is sort of deals with emotional issues sort of by design, and I think that's something that all of us up here like about the commission is that we're dealing with stuff that's very important and emotional. We're not talking about how many stripes to paint on a highway or, you know, how many trees go in Golden Gate Park or something like that. We're talking about stuff that really gets to people's emotions. And because of that, we have often emotional debates or discussions here, and today is certainly going to be no different. And I just would commend all of you that if you disagree with someone, they have as much right to be here as you do, and I expect civility among the speakers, and I'm sure we won't have to visit this topic again. So that's much appreciated, and I thank Marcus for saying that in the first. According to my yellow card and the outline that we have, Thea Hillman is our first speaker. I'm sorry, I went by the cards. Dr. Larry Baskin is our first speaker. Dr. Baskin, how are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. Speak to. Okay. Well, thanks for inviting me. I have a lot of trepidation for being here, quite frankly. Marcus, who's Marcus? I've been emailing him. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to work with you. I just heard a statement that there's 40 intersex surgeries done at UCSF every year. Is that correct?
This is what Dr. Grumbach said to me.
I think one would be more appropriate, okay, just for the record.
Okay, Dr. Baskin, I understand that you are a doctor at UCSF?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. I'm a pediatric urologist at UCSF. I take care of children 100% of the time, and I deal with patients who are born with ambiguity. I received a letter to come speak here, which I was not really thrilled about, quite frankly, but I thought it was my obligation as a faculty member at UCSF to address these issues. The title of the hearing is to provide a forum for all perspectives in regard to infant general surgery and hormonal treatment to establish a gender in infants with intersex anatomy, which is not really how we do things. We don't do surgery to establish a diagnosis. We don't give hormones. From that perspective, we do give hormones for treatment the same way hormones are given if you're missing hormones for women as well as for men.
Well, Dr. Baskin, let me just say, first of all, we appreciate your coming down. And if this was something you're not looking forward to, we appreciate it even more. And we will offer you a civil environment to present your position and the position of UCSF. And
I can just represent myself as a faculty member. We don't really have a position.
Fantastic. Well, where
is this being televised? I mean, I wasn't told about all this kind of stuff. I have a slide presentation, which I don't think I'm going to show because I'm not comfortable doing that. And the pictures are quite, I'm not sure they're for really public divulgation.
Okay, well, let me suggest to you why you were invited down from our perspective, and then you're free to say whatever it is
Sure.
you want to say. When this issue first came to the commission, obviously this is something that we wanted to become educated on and something that we didn't know a great deal about. So before we took any action, made any suggestions, anything like that. We figured it most important to get perspectives and to get diverse perspectives. And obviously on an issue like this that involves medical procedures, one of the most important things we thought was to get input from the medical community and what current standards are, what views are. So that was the reason you were invited here, and I would welcome you to offer whatever input you can personally or from the medical community, and we would appreciate that and consider it.
Well taken. I mean, this is a very controversial topic, is my guess why I'm here, but I look at this as actually very straightforward. 99% of patients who are born with some type of sexual ambiguity, and they come, I'm just going to give you a little lecture, if that's okay, of my understanding of this, and I have some material to submit, which are chapters I've written and chapters that Dr. Grumbach, who's chief of pediatric endocrinology, who's out of town, who couldn't make it, has also submitted. There's really four groups of patients that we deal with. There are children who are born, and you can't tell the parents whether it's a boy or a girl. And that becomes a little bit of a crisis in this country because of our culture, in that basically two sexual identities are accepted at birth, not sexual preferences, sexual identities. The gender that people associate with their body, are they a man or are they a woman? We can't tell sometimes, we're just doctors. So we try to figure out the best we can based on genetics, your chromosomes, XY, XX, which are basically, I think as most of us know, determined by the egg and the sperm, okay? We then have a group of patients who don't present in the neonatal period, in the newborn period, but present later on. For example, they start to change. Their phenotype, how they look, starts to change. They initially may have looked like a girl, and then they start to look like a boy. So that's very confusing, and those patients would seek medical care. We then have a group of patients who are diagnosed now prenatally. In other words, a lot of women in this country have ultrasounds and have amniocentesis. You do an amniocentesis, and the chromosomes are XY, but when the baby's born, it's discordant in that it looks like a girl as opposed to the XY chromosome, which would be a boy. That's very, very confusing. That wasn't picked up beforehand, and those patients are in this umbrella group of quote-unquote intersex per se. Okay, everybody following me? The chromosomes seem to be very, very critical, as well as afterwards the environment. As I tell my patients, it's not what between your legs, it's what between your ears that ultimately counts in this world. San Francisco is a great place to live because I think we're a little bit more, well, let me put it this way. I voted for somebody who won finally in an election, happened to be our mayor, and my kids congratulated me for that because I never vote for people who win in national office, it seems like. But that's another perspective. San Francisco seems to be a little more of a better place to live from that perspective. Now, if you look around the whole world, there's lots of different cultures. And when babies are born, and this is just, it's not my personal feeling, it's just kind of the general of what I have learned as I travel throughout the world. If you're born, for example, in Saudi Arabia, and you look anything like a boy, you are a boy. Doesn't matter what's inside, doesn't matter what your chromosomes are, because you get all the inheritance. Males are much more important in that society, and girls, unfortunately, aren't. And so you're a boy. So there would be no issue from the perspective of trying to make a proper diagnosis based on chromosomes, testing, etc. Let me give you another example. If you're born, for example, in the Dominican Republic or New Guinea, and there's a couple other places, there's a group of patients who are born, and I'm going to talk a little bit about this, who have sexual ambiguity, and when they're born at our hospital, we have a huge team. We used to consider this 15, 20 years ago kind of a social emergency that you have to tell the mom and dad it's a boy or girl within 24 hours. Everybody has to know. Now we don't. We realize that sex evolves. Okay, your identity can evolve. You can be a boy and then be a girl. I mean, I think we've made a lot of progress with all this, and you don't have to make that assignment on an emergency basis. Now, I want to put this in perspective. It happens once or twice a year in our hospital, maybe half a dozen times, and the diagnosis in 99% of the cases is very straightforward, very clear. We have excellent long-term follow-up in respect to how these babies do when they're older. In other words, their diagnosis, we can predict what's going to happen, and I think give the family very good counseling. Okay. There are many, many diagnoses. I can't give you a pediatric, you know, urology endocrine lecture, you know, in 5 minutes or so, but at least I can try to kind of give you a flavor. It's not made without these assignments are not made without, obviously, a lot of, you know, careful thinking from the endocrinologist, the pediatric urologist, myself, clergy, family, the family's culture, et cetera. And when that assignment is made, we used to basically say, you're a boy, this is 15, 20 years ago, and you're always going to be a boy, but we realized that was wrong because genes seem to be really critical in this, not blue genes, your chromosome genes, XY, XX. So if you have XY, and you guys read the lay press as much as I do because I get it from my friends who, you know, read the books and are out there, it turns out that you're really strongly going to identify as a boy. Now, each patient has to be treated individually, so you can't make blanket statements like that. But in general, the kids we see with real severe anomalies who were converted, so to speak, to girls because they had no phallus, which was kind of the crux of the issue because it's hard to reconstruct that surgically many, many years ago, seem to now identify as boys in spite of this surgery. So we've stopped doing that, not me, but our group. I'm speaking for surgeons and endocrinologists in general. And basically, we let the sex evolve, and there are kids who change their sex. In our society, it's not as well accepted. In San Francisco, you have kind of a chance, but in a lot of other places in the States, you don't, which is really a shame. So we obviously take this very seriously. The number of patients that I see, which we just can't make a decision, is less than 1% of my practice, and then we don't make a decision. The bottom line, if you can't put it back, don't take it out. Okay, that's kind of a surgical add-up. In other words, don't do anything that's irreversible. And see what happens with the patient and see where they're going to evolve. And as hard as it is to tell the family, don't be a boy, or is it a boy, is it a girl, if you can't make that statement, we simply can't make that statement. We're just doctors. We're nothing more than doctors and to try to facilitate what's going on. Another example I was going to give you before I started to rampage and tangentially talk, which I like to, was other cultures where it is acceptable to be a boy and then change into a girl, but more acceptable in the Dominican Republic in a disease called 5-alpha reductase deficiency, which is basically an enzyme. Some of the men in the room may know this because it's medicine you take for prostate problems, but it's an enzyme that converts testosterone, which is the male hormone, to a more active form of it, and these people are missing it. Very common genetic problem. And so when they're born, they have something called hypospadias, which is an abnormality where it can be very severe, where they look like a girl, but then as they go through puberty and start to make more hormone, that overwhelms the naturally occurring what should be there, and they end up basically turning from a girl into a boy phenotypically, and the society accepts that. They start as a girl, they end up as a male, they're a third sex in between, and then they can reproduce and they're fertile. It's not accepted really in our society. Our society basically accepts your body as a male or a female. Fortunately, in this day and age, we're starting to come up with a concept, not me, but the concept of a third sex was fine. In other words, evolving and stuff, and frankly, it's none of people's business. So I think we've made great strides. One of the big issues in the past is we did too much surgery, which we rarely do. I mean, I can't remember the last time I've done any type of irreversible surgery, and I kind of control it up in my institution. So I think that's good, and I think pretty much across the country, we've done a pretty good job with that. There are certain patients who I really empathize with who've had terrible outcomes, but I just want to make the statement that I think from my perspective, the patients I see, 99% of them are very straightforward. When you have a patient who's not XY and not XX, in other words, who's XX, XY, XO, in other words, the chromosomes are screwed up, you got a little bit of this, a little bit of that, so it's not straightforward, becomes very complex on how to deal with this, and those are in less than 1% of the situation.
We can ask you questions. I'd just like to go back over the surgery point, because as we're sort of preparing for this and getting bits and pieces of information, which is, you know, the reason we have this hearing is to get the full information, there was some suggestion that surgery was a standard, perhaps acceptable approach, or at least there was some information presented to me that suggested that surgery was sort of a common, if not the gold standard, response to these issues as they arose. If you could just walk us through briefly what happens when one of these, when an issue like this arises with a newborn child. What does the medical staff that you're familiar with, what do they do, and does that differ around the country or around the city?
Let me give you an example, because when I'm asked to see a patient with ambiguous genitalia, the diagnosis is congenital adrenal hyperplasia 85 to 90% of the time. Okay, let me explain what that is. Congenital adrenal hyperplasia, I feel bad because there's people back there. I guess they can hear me. I don't like to talk when I'm back to them. Congenital adrenal hyperplasia is an enzyme defect in the adrenal gland. I'm sure some people in the room probably have this. It's relatively common. It's genetically inherited by a recessive mode. And what happens is that the hormone or the enzymes that are missing, there's a whole slew of them, but there's some that are very common, is with that block in that enzyme, the normal hormones that are made get shunted over to testosterone, the male hormone. So if you happen to be a female and your parents both have the recessive gene and you end up with congenital adrenal hyperplasia, what happens is during pregnancy, your body as the fetus makes a lot of testosterone. Okay, and testosterone, we know that we all start out in the indifferent stage at 7 to 8 weeks gestation, normal's 40 weeks. And then under the influence of testosterone and that other hormone, dihydrotestosterone, the more powerful one I talked about, boys basically turn into boys and girls end up being girls. And girls are not a default pathway because there's some complex stuff that happens, but basically without testosterone, you end up being a girl. Okay, so these kids with the enzyme defect, their XX, which is the female karyotype, they get the hormone shunted into their system, and they end up looking like a male, varying degrees, okay? They can look like a complete male in the worst-case scenario. I've seen that once in my life, okay? If they were born in the Gaza Strip, Saudi Arabia, anywhere in the Far East, or anywhere in China, they'd be raised as males. On their inside, they have ovaries, they have a uterus, they have complete potential for fertility as a female, they can carry babies, and they can do extremely well. The overwhelming majority of cases is you have some degree of clitoral hypertrophy. You with me on this? So basically the clitoris or the penis, the same analogous structure, but with a male hormone you can make it look like a penis. To make it look completely like a normal penis with the urethral opening at the tip, incredibly rare. Okay? So you have some varying degrees. The bottom line, is it bad to have a big clitoris? I don't know, it's probably good. I don't know. Probably not. So we rarely ever do surgery to make the clitoris smaller. Historically, surgery was done on the clitoris, and in the worst-case scenario, my colleagues in the distant past, we used to remove the clitoris. It's still done in a lot of parts of the world, not for this, for other reasons. Okay, that was called a clitorectomy. Bad idea. The clitoris serves the same function as the penis, erections, nerves, the whole business. So now, on the very extremely rare case when we do surgery on the clitoris, I can't remember the last time I've done it, quite frankly, we know where the nerves are. We've done a huge number of studies. The same way we know where the nerves are in the penis, we can preserve erectile function for the clitoris, just like the penis, and we can make it smaller if we have to. And that's a very rare case scenario. The problem with the little girls is that they end up having a common urogenital sinus. Okay, let me explain that. Girls have three holes, the rectum, okay, anus, that's one, the vagina, that's two, the urethra, that's three. In congenital adrenal hyperplasia, the urethra and the vagina basically form out together into one hole, so they don't have a separate hole for the vagina. So the surgery that we do on the girls is basically to separate the vagina from the urethra so they can be normal. We have excellent long-term follow-up on kids with congenital adrenal hyperplasia, and they have families, they can have children, they're normal girls. They have to take hormones to shunt, to block that production of testosterone for their whole life, but they can be normal. In half of the, well, don't quote me on this number, but in a certain number of patients who have congenital adrenal hyperplasia, they're not only missing the hormone that allows that testosterone to form, but they're also missing a hormone that controls our water balance. And they basically will die immediately within the first 2 weeks of life. They come in with failure to thrive and they die. If you look in the old textbooks, a third of the patients with this disease were female, and the two-thirds were male. Well, it turns out that it's half and half, but all of the girls died because nobody recognized it. Okay, so that's a serious emergency crisis. So any patient with ambiguous genitalia, I'm going to answer your question, What we do is we look at them and we get blood tests to make sure that they don't have the salt-losing form of congenital adrenal hyperplasia. And then we do number of tests, blood tests. We do x-rays. We do ultrasounds. We have a big meeting with everybody involved. We do other testing, and then we come up with, do we have an exact diagnosis? If we have an exact diagnosis, we present it to the family and give them the options. And then if it's something that's straightforward, from my perspective, I have 150 years of endocrinology experience in my colleagues, and they're a little more senior than me, then we basically tell the family and we go from there in terms of the treatment. If we don't have an exact diagnosis, we get help, and then we just let things evolve. We may say, you know what, let's see what happens. Let's see what the family wants, and then we go from there. Surgery is recommended for a couple of different reasons. One, that common urogenital sinus business, okay? So if there's no vagina, we do surgery. I do it early because the kids don't remember. Anesthesia is very safe, and I think that's the way to go. And also, there's a number of patients who have gonad issues. We haven't talked about that. If it's a testicle, that's fine. If it's an ovary, that's fine. But if it's somewhere in between, then there's cancer issues. We know that a lot of these patients will get cancer, and so we remove the discordant gonads if it's straightforward. If we don't know, then we don't know, and that's what we offer the families. And that's typically done at puberty. It can be done early, but I think they have hormone function, so I like to wait later on, because then you're really nailed down your gender identity and there's no issues there, and then the kid's involved with all this.
Okay, and I appreciate, Doctor, that these sort of bottom-line questions are difficult and that this is a very complicated issue, but just one more sort of question to give me just a general sense of this. In babies presenting ambiguous genitalia, what percentage of those, in your experience at UCSF and really around the greater Bay Area, result in some sort of childhood surgery? Now, not
just 1%.
Okay.
I want to make one statement about hypospadias, which is an abnormality in males who have XY chromosomes, where 98% of these kids, maybe 99, have a straightforward problem. It's not intersex. I don't want that lumped in here. Okay, this is a kid who has a cleft lip or a cleft palate that you would never consider not fixing, has an extra arm, extra digits, congenital anomaly, you fix it.
Okay, and then just to follow up, is there sort of a standard protocol that is followed when it's not a wait and see method? Is it a hormone treatment? Is it I guess what I'm getting at is I want to know, other than the surgery option, what option are the parents presented with in this sort of situation?
Observation. Let me comment on hormones because you brought it up, because we haven't really discussed that. There are situations where kids are born, males are born with a very tiny penis, okay, a microphallus. And there's excellent long-term follow-up to show that they can have normal sex, have kids, and be fine. There was this concept in the past that to have sex, you had to have penile-vaginal penetration, which is not how sex is defined. Sex is defined by kissing, by touching, by many other things. It's not just that defines sex. So in a situation where the penis is just very small, and also has an abnormality like hypospadias, you may want to see if it's going to grow or not. Okay, you wouldn't gender convert the patient to a female. We know that was a disaster. That was done 15, 20 years ago. It doesn't work. You can give them hormones. When a baby is in utero, the boys are receiving a lot of stimulation. That's how they become boys. Once you're born, that testosterone goes away, and basically from 3 months of age until puberty, there's no male hormone around. You with me? You can give them hormones. It was done for the classic treatment of undescended testes, the male hormone, in many different forms. In Europe, you can rub cream on. You can give shots, which work centrally. Bottom line, they all make the body make testosterone. So you have a little teenager walking around who's 2 or 6 months or 3 months. The bottom line is it tests the access of whether it's working or not. Because if you don't have the hormone working, there's many reasons. Are you missing the receptor? In other words, do you have a key but no lock to open? And so this helps in the differential diagnosis. It's not really treatment, it's diagnosis. So if you give the hormone and that penis grows, that's very reassuring to the family that when he goes through puberty, he's going to be a normal kid, because you have parents who are obviously very distraught over this whole situation.
Okay, and this sort of presentation that you're giving us as to how the medical community responds, or at least how in your experience, is that prevalent around the country, or does this vary by region within the country or hospital staffs or faculties?
I think that there's some controversy on specific diagnosis, but at our meetings there's some controversy on techniques. There's some variation, but I think people are pretty much on board.
When you say your meetings, you mean urology conferences, or?
Yeah, American Academy of Pediatric,
right.
Section on urology meetings, okay. The pediatric endocrine meetings.
Very good. Commissioner Kahn, that suggested you had a question, and I see it removed.
You asked my question.
Okay, great. Are there any, Commissioner Grigg, do you have a question for the doctor?
Yeah, just following up on your reference to conferences for pediatric urology, to what extent do such conferences, what percentage of your activities does this the subject matter occupy? Is it the subject of active, ongoing discussions and an evolving practice, or is it considered by practitioners to be more or less a settled area as it sits today?
No, definitely not settled. Definitely evolving. We've made great strides, I think, with just the concept that sex can evolve. You don't need to make this emergency sex assignment. You can be not necessarily a boy or a girl for a while until it gets figured out. It may never get figured out. I'll put in some material. There was a big consensus meeting where nobody came up with a consensus basically over the last 4 or 5 years. We have another one next April that's going to be really nice because it's going to be combined endocrinologists and urologists. Treatment of ambiguous genitalia type stuff. And so this is very active. And I think about 10% to 15% of our meeting is devoted to this. There's always some big panel discussion that we struggle with in terms of when should patients have evaluation. If you do surgery, what type of surgery? When should the surgery be done? What time of hormonal treatment? What are the long-term outcomes? Let's evaluate the surgery that was done in the past. You know, one of the problems, we're trying to do databases and registries, but this HIPAA thing, in other words, patient, that's killing us because it's impossible to really identify the patients. And, you know, the patients that I see, the satisfied customers don't come back. I mean, they're a done deal and stuff. The ones who have had, you know, terrible outcomes, which I empathize with, that's terrible and stuff. And, you know, we do the best we can.
Now, when you have these types of conferences that you've discussed, is there an interdisciplinary aspect? You've mentioned endocrinologists and urologists, but child psychiatrists or sociologists or other, non-medical scientists perhaps. I guess psychiatrists or medical scientists. But others who practice in the area who contribute to your base of knowledge for developing your practices in this area?
We definitely have psychiatrists. Is Cheryl here? Cheryl Chase, who developed, I'm forgetting an acronym, has done more for this whole field, I think, than any physician.
And what's her professional area?
I think she's an attorney. do you know Marcus?
Cheryl is the founder of the Intersex Society of North America.
Thank you. North American Intersex. So there's another group called NAFTI, and I confuse them, but I've met her a number of times, and we've had a lot of input from people who have had these problems, who have become, you know, advocates, and I think that's been incredibly useful.
Any further commissioner questions? Seeing none, Dr. Baskin, I hope that wasn't as awful as you thought it might
no,
be.
It wasn't too bad.
All right, very good. Well, thank you very much for your time, and this is, as I say, an ongoing process, and we'll hope we can consider you a resource as we go forward, as well as the UCSF staff, so thank you. Earlier we heard from a representative of Assemblyman Leno's office. We are also privileged to have with us actually himself, Supervisor Dufty from District 8 here in San Francisco. Supervisor Dufty, welcome.
Thank you. Thank the commissioners, and I want to thank you and the excellent staff of the Human Rights Commission for devoting time to this important issue. It's great to see many of the commissioners, many of you fairly new commissioners who I've known before, and I appreciate the Human Rights Commission's trailblazing work for the LGBTQI community. And I know that there are people from the intersex community who feel very passionately about issues of treatment and issues of understanding how we as a society respond to these issues. And so I'm really grateful to be here to listen to the testimony that will follow and to looking forward to the report and recommendations that you'll make. So thank you for having
me. Thank you for coming down. Supervisor Duffy is certainly a friend to the commission and as well as the advisory committee, which he attends rather regularly, and we appreciate him very much. Moving back to the agenda, Marcus, which I will do unless you throw something at me, we have...
Pardon me, Commissioner, if you could remind the folks in the audience about their cell phones.
Oh, yes, you gave me a note on that. Although I began the meeting by saying that I would keep my cell phone on, I did that because, one, I'm under sort of extreme circumstances, which we hope you can appreciate, and number two, because the general rule is we can't have cell phones on. I think that's a decorum rule as well as actually a technology rule. Some of that interference you heard earlier may have had something to do with cell phone reception. I don't know. It's not my area of expertise, but Marcus tells me to tell you to turn off your cell phone, so please do it. Our next speaker is Thea Hillman. Good evening, Ms. Hillman.
Commissioners, I want to thank you very much for recognizing the issue of intersex treatment and for taking the time to dedicate this very important issue. I also want to let you know that I am bringing the support and love of Cheryl Chase, the founder of the Intersex Society of North America, who really wanted to be here, but she is in a wheelchair. She broke her foot 2 weeks ago. So I'm speaking to you today as a person with an intersex condition and as an advocate for patient-centered care for people with intersex conditions. And when I say intersex, I mean people born with sex anatomy that somebody decided isn't standard for male or female. Now, some doctors may not call some of the things that I'm calling intersex, intersex. So I want to explain that what I'm calling intersex is things like large clitorises, small penises, including, you know, let's say hypospadias, where the hole comes out somewhere other than the tip of the penis. I'm talking about any kind of sex anatomy variation that gets the attention of doctors. It may or not be ambiguity or discordance between the chromosomes or the anatomy, but the standard of care for these people is medical intervention. So I just wanted to let you know my definition. I'm here today because I believe that infants and people with intersex are being discriminated against by well-meaning physicians whose treatment model for intersex is shaped by ignorance and fear of sexual difference. I believe parents are consistently misled and even defrauded by these well-meaning but dangerously ill-informed doctors. I have a condition that you've already heard about today. It's called congenital adrenal hyperplasia. I've known since I was very little that I have a medical condition, what my mom described to me when I was a young kid as an enzyme imbalance. I had pubic hair at 4 years old. I was proud of having this pubic hair before other kids had it. I felt that it made me special. I took medication and I wore a medical alert bracelet, and these made me feel special too. What was hard for me about having CAH was the social and emotional aspects of developing faster than my peers. Because of my condition, I had androgens running through my body before other kids did. These were hormones that made my brain and my body develop early. I had sexual feelings long before other kids. This precociousness made it hard for me to relate to kids my age. Around age 6, I started taking medication to slow my development and stave off puberty until a more traditional age, say 13, and this would also help me reach a normal height. While receiving this medical treatment to normalize me, I received no counseling or psychological support to deal with my sexually, intellectually, and socially advanced development. I got teased a lot as a kid because I was different. Even if other kids couldn't see my difference, which was my pubic hair, they could sense my difference. Part of my treatment was close monitoring from doctors. From the age of 4 on, my genitals were regularly and very closely examined by male doctors every few months. It became clear to me that my difference, what was wrong with me, came from my sex, my privates, an area that I knew I was supposed to keep private, but which I had to be willing to show to doctors upon request. I had excellent support from my parents, my mother especially, and a caring doctor. However, these frequent examinations and a general lack of understanding of how such genital exams impact a child have left me with some of the emotional scars of a sexual abuse survivor. The first time I heard the word intersex, I was 29 years old and met a neighbor across the street, David Cameron. He had an intersex condition called Klinefelter syndrome. Thus became the process of me recognizing myself as a person with an intersex condition, not just as somebody with a medical condition. To me, this awareness was a recognition of the ways in which I had been treated as somebody with a body that was freakish and in need of fixing or correcting. That's what I think about intersex treatment. Today, I believe I received very good treatment. I believe my parents did the right things for me. However, I wish I had been told about the social repercussions of my condition, and I wish I had known it was okay to be different sexually. This would have saved me a lot of soul-searching, alienation, and grief. As an adult, I've gained a great deal of comfort and self-awareness through my connections with other people with intersex conditions. I am an advocate for better treatment for intersex people, treatment that we often call patient-centered treatment, and there's a standard for this that was created by the Intersex Society of North America, and I'll describe this later. I have met too many people with intersex conditions who have horror stories to tell about their lives, their treatments, and their families. Many of these people have become my close friends, and I witness on a regular basis how shame, secrecy, and medically unnecessary surgeries have traumatized them, made relationships especially difficult for them, and made them both horribly afraid and inextricably linked to the doctors who hurt them. I have heard endless stories of people being lied to by their parents and doctors. I have heard of people being taken to the hospital with no idea why and waking up with bandages around their genitals. I've heard stories of friends being born with genitals that had sexual function and sensation and then being given surgery that took both away. I have heard of people who received so-called repair surgeries and then the next surgery failed and then the next surgery failed and then they were on their 16th surgery in 23 years. I've heard stories about loss of continence from surgery, chronic infections and illness due to surgery, and I have heard of stories of surgically created vaginas that leak, that smell, and that come unattached from the body. I've heard stories about repeated genital displays to medical doctors and students, and I've heard of families destroyed by the secrets and pain and shame. The stories about intersex treatment that I have heard do not center around being raised as the wrong gender, although this has happened to some people I know. What intersex people feel most scarred by is being lied to and being treated as if their bodies are freakish, shameful, and something to be fixed and then never spoken of again. I'm advocating for patient-centered treatment because the current medical model for people with intersex conditions asserts that intersex is a rare abnormality, even though intersex is as common as cystic fibrosis, which is something that you've probably all heard much more about. A recent article that appeared last year in the Journal of Pediatric Health, this is the first sentence of the article, states that next to perinatal death, genital ambiguity is likely the most devastating condition to face any parent of a newborn. The current treatment model states that intersex is pathological and should be treated as a psychosocial emergency with immediate attention because children with visibly ambiguous anatomy cannot possibly develop into healthy adults. Doctors recommend emergency sex assignment and reinforcement of the sex of assignment with early genital surgery. The model of treatment says that these people and their parents can't handle the truth about their intersex status, so it also encourages the care providers to be less than honest with the parents and to tell the parents to be less than honest with the kids about their status and about their options for care. For this reason, myself and others call the current treatment model the concealment-based model of treatment for intersex because it seeks to fix or normalize intersex by withholding information from the patient and performing surgery which attempts to hide the physical and diagnostic evidence that the child was ever different or anything other than normal. In the U.S. every day, 5 children are subjected to these harmful, medically unnecessary sexual surgeries. I'm advocating for patient-centered treatment because I believe that the concealment model is informed by homophobia. The current concealment-based model is most concerned with gender and normalization. Gender and normal in this case mean that the child grew up to be heterosexual, having genitals that are able to have heterosexual sex. The genitals need to look normal. If a girl is born with a large clitoris, for example, it is reduced so as not to look like a phallus. If a boy is born with a penis that is too small to penetrate a woman, it is reduced and he is assigned a girl and receives surgery to reinforce this assignment. This is still happening all over the country. A girl born without a vagina or with a short vagina is given surgery to enlarge her vagina so that it's large enough to accommodate a penis. but baby girls don't need vaginas. Sexual pleasure or ability to orgasm are not prioritized. When I have heard the doctors who deal with intersex talk, and I've actually been invited to speak at a conference of international pediatric endocrinologists, their success stories always include a heterosexual marriage and the adoption of children. The model of success for treatment is extremely limited. It does not include quality of life issues such as happiness, successful relationships, or sexual health, nor does it include the concept that a person being gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender is an acceptable outcome. A model of patient-centered care would look like this. It would focus on the child as the patient, not the parent or the society. It would not treat a parent's distress by surgery on a child. It would support open and honesty. It would advocate for mental health care, essential for the child and the parent, and advocating the idea that surgery done for the sake of normalizing is not medically necessary. It is not essential. It would advocate raising the child as a boy or a girl without surgery, based on the best information available about what they will most likely identify as when they are later, but with the understanding that child might change their gender later when they're old enough to tell us, which is actually true about intersex children and non-intersex children. Here are my recommendations. My endocrinologist recently told me that he was never taught about sex. He's actually at UCSF. His name is Blake Terrell. He said he was never taught about sex in medical school. Cheryl Chase has attended conferences of pediatric endocrinologists and urologists who actually thanked her for educating them about the importance of the clitoris for women's sexual pleasure. There must be required education for doctors, and these are practicing and students. There must be education about sex and sexual function. This is for understanding of how their actions might affect a child's future and to better serve that child as an adult. In addition, sensitivity or diversity training is needed to educate doctors about gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender issues so that they don't fear these people as the worst outcome or as failed treatments. Recommendation. Make hospitals account for treatment of intersex to a panel outside of the urology or endocrinology departments. I mean no disrespect to anybody, but I want to say that as a long-term advocate in a movement that is over 10 years old, the doctors who perform these surgeries have now begun to respond to our recommendations in name only. And I believe that they know the rhetoric, but that their practices have not changed. They will tell us at conferences that surgeries are better now, which actually is what we believe is actually beside the point, because we're talking about medically unnecessary surgeries. And because it's a peer-based field, it's allowable for them to continue doing their actions because they review each other. I could say more about that if you have questions. Recommendation, make mandatory that any hospital that has intersex patients referred to it have a response team that includes a social worker and a psychotherapist. Recommendation, make mandatory a treatment protocol that differentiates between medically necessary and cosmetic surgeries and clarifies this difference to parents. Recommendation, make mandatory education for doctors that includes how to talk to parents of newborns with intersex in a way that helps those parents be comfortable with and accept their child. Consider educating the parents to use the word intersex in addition to the particular condition to make it easier for the parent to find peer support. Recommendation, make mandatory that any doctor dealing with intersex children meet adults with intersex conditions, especially those who haven't had surgery, to be sensitized to the fact that it's possible to grow up and thrive with a body that's different. To assure these doctors that holding off on surgery isn't doing nothing. That they can treat any underlying medical concerns, including medically necessary surgeries, that they can refer that parent to support groups and counsel openness and honesty with their child. I want to clarify that I am not advocating that we invent new sexes. I'm not advocating for a radical restructuring of society or of needing gender to be eliminated or restructured. I'm also not anti-treatment or anti-doctor. I would like to empower doctors to give patients and their parents the best care available. I believe that everyone deserves information to make educated choices about their own bodies, and that may include surgery when that person is old enough to tell us what they want. Lack of disclosure about intersex status, lack of proper counseling, lack of referrals to other parents and people with intersex conditions are keeping people with intersex isolated and ashamed. The highest court in the country of Colombia, the Constitutional Court, found that what doctors were doing there violated the human rights of people with intersex conditions. As a remedy, They mandated a new kind of informed consent that tries to put the long-term needs of the child over the needs of the doctors or the parents who might be disturbed by intersexuality. There are models for change and for better treatment of people with intersex conditions. As of today, no city or state in the United States has taken action on this issue. The concealment model is practiced throughout the U.S. as it's the standard of care. San Francisco has a historic opportunity to be a leader in advocating for patient-centered care for people with intersex. Thank you so much for your time and your attention.
It's a good sign when we want to ask questions. Don't run away. You said a lot, and I see that some other commissioners want to ask questions, so I'll try to avoid my usual tendency to hog. And but I will start with the first question because I think this is important to just clarify. You said a lot about counseling, about considering child's needs, about counseling that doesn't reinforce discriminatory stereotypes. Those are all very important issues, and I want to talk about that. And when Ben and I first talked about this issue two summers ago or last summer, those were some of the issues that we hit on. Before we get there, I know you're very active in this, and I know that Dr. Baskin actually mentioned your group's head or founder, and so there's obviously some sort of dialogue and mutual respect, or at least respect from Dr. Baskin there. The story that he gave us about surgery and its use and the story that you gave us are really disparate. Does that mean that Dr. Baskin is telling us what you think is the rhetoric? Does that mean that UCSF is ahead of the game, as you would put it? How do I reconcile the fact that I have, I would assume, a very respected endocrinologist, he's got a position at UCSF, and we all know that's a great hospital, and you, a very eloquent activist, you know, really with the lead organization, telling me two different things in the scope of 10 minutes?
Well, I'll tell you the best answer to that question, the most positive answer first, and then I'll tell you the less positive answer second. The first more positive answer is that the medical establishment is changing, is beginning to listen to the fact that there's a problem. And I do believe, in answer to your earlier question, that treatment does vary across the country and does vary actually hospital to hospital. But the current standard of care is still emergency sex assignment and following up with surgery. I heard some things from Dr. Baskin that I was quite heartened by, and I would think it would be wonderful if that was the truth. It's possible that is
right.
True.
Well, not in Dr. Baskin's defense, but he did suggest that he and his colleagues have acquired a great deal of information over the years, and he quite candidly said that treatments that may have been in existence 15 years ago were just wrong, which you don't hear a doctor say all that often. So I was struck by that. But what I really want to get a sense of, and it may be hard without polling the medical community throughout the country, is what is going on? What is the medical response to this issue when it comes up?
Well, I will tell you the less positive answers to this issue, which is that doctors are very scared. It's an issue at which they could be, there's a lot of legal ramifications to the work that they're doing. And it's the people who are pediatric endocrinologists and urologists are a pretty conservative lot. They are all trained from a few different doctors at Johns Hopkins, and the older sort of school of these doctors are the ones who are the peers, per se, that set the standard of care, and they are not changing. And what I would just like to say is that when I've been at conferences and we've heard doctors talk, they've said they don't do these surgeries or they don't do clitorectomies anymore, they just do clitoral reductions. Well, that may be true, but the problem is that clitoral reduction isn't necessary. Hypospadias surgery in most cases is actually not necessary. Doing anything to a micropenis is not necessary. I think the second half of my point was going to be that I think we have different definitions of intersex or the problem surrounding intersex. I think Dr. Baskin's definition of intersex is much more limited than mine. I'm talking about any kind of sex anatomy abnormality that's receiving medical intervention that's unnecessary, where it's not going to save the child from illness or pain that's not going to help them function. These are cosmetic surgeries.
And so a potential way of reconciling, not that we have to reconcile, sometimes there are differences, but a potential way of reconciling what you've told us here today and what Dr. Baskin told us is that Dr. Baskin is dealing with a rather narrow universe, and maybe he and his colleagues are not performing surgery in that universe, but maybe at some other places there are. But you're sort of asking to push the dialogue to a larger universe of conditions or people, frankly, is what it is, and urge the sort of non-involvement, non-treatment in those situations as well.
Yes, and I'm also urging for an accounting of treatments that might not fall under the term of intersex by the particular institution or by the particular department that the urology or the endocrinology department, but that we would consider inappropriate surgeries.
I understand that, and I think that's is certainly a reasonable request. I think Dr. Baskin alluded to the fact that I think sort of logically, because this is a very personal issue, that might be hard to do, and now he's alluded to federal, you know, Health Portability Act requirements and things that might also make this a hard thing to do. So I understand the request. I also understand some of the obstacles we face there legally and personally. But, okay, let me honor my commitment not to be a time hog and call on Commissioner Khan.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. I guess I want to clarify. I guess I'm confused about hypospadia as an example, where, if I understand you correctly, you would say that in the absence of other medical complications, that this is cosmetic surgery. Is that what you're asking? And therefore, you would put it under the...
All the people that I know who've had hypospadias repair wish they hadn't had it.
And what's, without speaking for them, what are the kinds of concerns that people raise? Just that someone interfered with their body?
I know someone who, the person that I talked about that had 16 surgeries in 23 years, that was a hypospadias repair. That person spent every summer in the hospital until they were 23 years old.
Thank you.
Commissioner Larry Lee?
Yeah, Commissioner, you've asked the first question that I wanted to get answered. The second part is that you had several recommendations, and I just got writing through the first one. Have you got copies of that,
Absolutely.
Know, what your recommendations are so that you can give it to some of the commissioners?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Del Portillo?
Yes, I haven't heard anything in the testimony about the religious community, if they're involved. I assume they are when the parents would turn to whoever their religious consultant would be or advisor. I am curious as to what the position of the various communities happens to be, and I must tell you that I am being educated. I had no idea that conditions existed through the inheritance of specific or genes and so on in the Dominican Republic. That happens to be a Latino community, and I would very much like to know, how does the society react to it? Who makes the decisions? How do they handle it? Because that would give me a little bit of sense as to who's involved in making these decisions. It also tells me that there are certain areas in which our own community needs to be educated. And as an educator, I have the interest in that area to see what I can do about educating. Because if a community is undereducated or not educated at all, then there are people suffering. And I think the common good demands that those of us who can do something about it.
Well, I think that's a great question, and I think the reason that you haven't heard more about it is because it's about sex, and it's about genitals, and it's about children's genitals. And our society is very scared about talking about sex, and especially about children and sex. And I think, you know, the religious community is no different than any other community in terms of that. I will also tell you that the current model of treatment says tell the parents as little as possible, and then to not tell the child about their intersex status, to do surgery and to do whatever medical treatment is necessary, and to never tell them that there was ever any ambiguity, so that the child will accept their gender assignment. So it's part of the treatment model is the secrecy. And I can actually give you many articles that have been published within the last few years written by these doctors that are advocating for not telling as part of the treatment.
Commissioner Sokot?
I'd like to actually just follow up on that same point. And I'm wondering if you have some recommendations or what efforts are being made even in your own work to have broader community education about this and what might come forward even here.
Well, the Intersex Society of North America has been around for about 12 years, and we have a patient-centered model of care that we are advocating for. We are now working on medical student education because we've had a very tough time talking to the current practicing doctors. And so now we are working with students to help educate around sex and around intersex issues. We have a parent's handbook for parents of children with intersex, and we have a clinician's handbook to help doctors deal with this issue, which is confusing to them. I think you heard that today. It's a confusing and traumatizing issue even for the doctors to deal with. I will also tell you, on our board, the Intersex Society of North America has a medical advisory board of 26 doctors from around the country who've signed on to our mission and are helping advise us in a model of care that would be amenable to the medical community as well.
Well, I suspect we're going to hear more about this, but it seems to me that the focus is sort of designing a model of care that's a little less secretive, a little more advice-driven, and a little more open and less discriminatory, which all sounds like noble goals. I have to tell you, as someone who's on the eve of fatherhood, that's certainly what I would expect from our doctors, and if it were anything different, I'd be sort of upset about it if I found out about it later. One question that sort of follows up on this, and just to get back to the models that are in use today, is there any sort of cataloging as to what hospitals or medical communities are using as their model of care, or is that too inefficient because we're not really sure if they're following the printed model of care?
We don't have anything of that, and because of patient privacy,
But more generally, if I were to call UCSF and just say generally, if this issue presents in a child that's born today, what are you going to do about it?
I would look for pediatric endocrinology departments and urology departments that deal with children.
And are they going to print or make public what their sort of standard or model of care is?
I don't think there's a listing of that kind of thing. I just think that they follow what's considered, you know, the American Academy of Pediatrics, what they feel is the standard of care.
Yeah.
And you can see that that's been recently upgraded or updated in the last couple of years.
Well, to me, I mean, this is sort of probably not news to you, but it would seem to me that continued work with the medical community on education and just openness and things like that is the way to go.
And I will tell you that we've been doing that and it's actually been changing. We were recently contacted by a hospital that's a little bit down the coast who let us know that they just are no longer referring these babies to the urologists. That's how change is happening. It's happening, you know, doctor by doctor. And people are just on a sort of subjective basis not referring on. So it's not a sort of revolutionary type change that's happening. It's, you know, people are hearing us speak. We speak at their conference. They read a paper that we publish, and it changes their mind, or it answers a question that they might have had about the effectiveness of the treatment.
Well, that's how revolutions get started. But
yes. I would not agree that there is data or that there is follow-up. And I would not say that a patient that you never hear from again is a happy patient. These people have been traumatized by the medical treatment that they've received. And what we feel is that many, many too many people have been lost to follow-up, actually. And while we have tried to do NAFTI, the North American Task Force on Intersex, actually was a group of medical professionals and the Intersex Society organized to look at this stuff and to actually get some data, because I think both sides actually agreed that we didn't have good data. And we couldn't even decide on what to look at. They were most concerned with gender assignment and whether those gender assignments were accepted. And we were looking at quality of life issues. And we didn't actually get any further than that.
Frankly, I have quite a few questions that I'd like to ask, but I think time is going to sort of force us to move on. And I just say that we appreciate your personal involvement, the involvement of your organization. One thing that you can't see because you're looking at me is every time you speak, there's about 20 people nodding behind you. So I know you represent a good many people, and we appreciate your coming down to I think, as Commissioner Del Portillo said very aptly, educate us on this. It sounds like you're doing great work already, but this is very helpful for us to learn what's going on. So thank you again for coming down. You will be here for the rest of the hearing? Great. Okay. Well, we might reserve the right to call you back up and quiz you some more. The next speaker I have a card for is Betsy Driver from Easton, Pennsylvania. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Fantastic.
That is
correct. Welcome to San Francisco.
It was decided on Friday, actually, that I would be attending, and I appreciate that you're considering intersex issues. It's a really big deal for many of us.
Well, I'm glad we have some fog for you today so you get the full San Francisco treatment.
I lived in Monterey for a while. I actually moved away. I wanted too much sunshine in my life. I wanted to tell you about my own story. I was born in the 1960s with an intersex condition you've already heard about, congenital adrenal hyperplasia. And at birth, my genitals were masculinized, and my parents were the doctors were unable to tell my parents if I was a boy or a girl. A few days later, they determined I was a girl because I had a uterus and ovaries. I was quickly scheduled for something called feminizing surgery. That is, I was scheduled to have my enlarged clitoris cut off of me. At the time, my parents were told very little, and like all parents of a newborn who isn't perfect, they were scared and willing to do whatever the doctors told them. And they were told that without this drastic surgery, I would grow up with gender problems, I would be a lesbian, or worse, I would commit suicide. At age 3 months, I underwent a total clitorectomy. In my medical records, it says the clitoris was amputated to the nub. My clitoris wasn't diseased, it wasn't causing me any medical problems, but it was because it was larger than what the doctors involved with my care deemed as normal, and therefore it was a social emergency in their eyes. During my childhood, there were many overnight hospital stays. Because they were allegedly routine, my parents did not always stay with me. One of my very earliest childhood memories is of being in the hospital at nighttime, away from the safety of my parents, and having a group of medical students in my room. They forced my legs apart while saying they needed to examine me. I never said a word about these exams, which were quite frequent, until I was an adult. I now see them for what they were, institutionalized sexual abuse perpetuated by those that I was supposed to trust, my doctors. More surgeries would follow in my early teens, each one another opportunity to be sexually abused by a fresh round of doctors not directly involved in my care, who once again needed to check me. One of those later surgeries left me incontinent. During another, to fix the incontinent problem, it was discovered that I was given a venereal disease, probably by one of the doctors who wanted to check me out. It had to have come from them because it would be another decade before I would become sexually active. All of these surgeries and attention paid to my genitals taught me from a very young age that my body was not acceptable and that I was to be ashamed by it. And it worked. My young adult years were fraught with peril and the inability to form bonds or a romantic relationship. It took years of therapy to get past it, much of it self-guided, as I discovered that therapists today, this was just a few years ago, were ill-equipped to handle someone with an intersex condition. It wasn't until I was in my 30s that all the pieces started to make sense. I got my medical records, and I learned the truth about the genital mutilation I was subjected to. I learned that my mother was lied to, and she learned that she was lied to by the very doctors she had entrusted my care to. And I met for the very first time, this was in my late 30s, someone else with a queer body. It was that moment that may have been the most healing in getting past my childhood horrors. Eventually, I used that angry energy to start an intersex peer support organization. Part of it was learning that there was another person my age with an intersex condition treated at the very same hospital I was at, and yet we were both told that there was nobody else like us. Our parents were told the same thing. In other words, we were lied to yet again. To this day, parents and their families are still not being referred to peer support, a healing mechanism that has proven to be a powerful source whenever there is trauma. And every day, my organization, Bodies Like Ours, hears from people all over the world, adults with intersex conditions, adults of all ages, from parents who feel they're being bullied into having surgery done on their children, who just want to meet another parent and they're being told they're the only ones, looking for somebody else to talk to that's been down their road. The shame, the secrecy, and deceit is a sad legacy that continues to be perpetuated on families and individuals this day by the medical caregivers who say that we need surgery. Thank you.
Thank you. thank you very much. You know, it's sort of a double-edged sword. Personal testimony or personal statements are often the most moving, but by the same token, they're often the most difficult. And so we appreciate your coming forward to tell your story. It's helpful to us, and I think it's along the lines of what you're talking about, a sort of peer support. Hopefully it's helpful for everybody. If I may, just maybe I will just note the questions as we're going forward, but that seems to me like a pretty simple one of peer support, that, you know, if a group of parents or, you know, a group of people with intersex condition can help one another, it seems to me that efforts to bring those people together would be fruitful, and I wonder why the hospitals or the various sort of places where these issues are going to come up are not sort of taking that effort if they're not. And I'd be curious to know what your organization is doing about that and what we could do to maybe help, at least in the Bay Area. If you want to come forward, please.
When we hear from new parents, what we do is we do a geographic check. You know, I try to find somebody else. We put an email call out, you know, is there somebody else in the area? Also, in our organization, we have public message forums, and many, many people connect through those.
When you say connect, you mean that's how they come in to contact you in the first place?
Well, contact either email, phone. We're on the internet.
Yeah, I'm certainly not questioning what goes on once the call or the contact is received.
Sure.
What I'm sort of getting at is how do we make that resource more available or accessible to people? Because if it's, as I'm sort of gathering, an issue that's often confronted with sort of secrecy and denial and other sort of harmful reactions, I'm wondering how we convince hospitals or, you know, other likely institutions to sort of promote the discussion that's going to help people deal with this.
Well, if parents know that those resources are out there, and like with bodies like ours, we are a non-condition-specific organization. However, there are some condition-specific organizations that are popping up. However, they're not run in association with hospitals. They're set up by parents who have been through this and went, why am I having to go through this by myself?
Right.
So the resources are out there. And, you know, if parents are privileged enough to have internet access, they often find it.
Right.
But if they don't have that internet access, they're often at a loss. You know, just last week I was on the phone with the mother of a child with congenital adrenal hyperplasia who, her baby is 2 years old now. For the first time in her life, she talked to another person with CAH. You know, but she found us on the internet.
Okay.
The resources need to be out there. I know with ISNA's, you know, parent handbook, that will be out there.
Right. Well, that's what I'm getting at. I mean, one of the things that we're looking at is trying to educate ourselves and then figure out what we can do within our relatively limited sphere and limited influence. And one thing that I would certainly want the task force to follow up on or at least think about is the extent to which we can encourage Bay Area hospitals or other institutions to make the resources of peer support, of counseling, at least known to parents and children. That just seems to me to be basic. I don't know what the status of that is, but I'll just simply, you know, note that, Marcus, that's one thing that her statements certainly make me think of. Commissioner Socott?
I just have a quick clarification question on that. Have you approached hospitals, because I know in my own experience in dealing with a life-threatening illness, when in the hospital was given a set of resources to call upon, have you, in approaching hospitals to offer your organization as a resource, have you been rebuffed or not received, or what has been the general environment for providing what you offer?
My organization, frankly, is very new and very underfunded, and we do try to reach out the best that we can. As far as doing actual outreach to hospitals, we have not actually reached that point in our growth stage yet to be able to do that. You know, the one thing I can say is that, you know, when we are contacted by a new parent or somebody who's searching for peer support, and when I pick up the phone and call a parent in that geographic area, they never say no. You know, I've never had somebody say, geez, I'd love to help out, but I can't do that. You know, it's always an enthusiastic yes.
Thank you very much for coming down. We wish you a safe trip home to Pennsylvania.
Thank you.
Next, I have Hida Valoria, I hope I'm pronouncing that right.
Very good job.
Yes, 15th Street, which I would choose over Pennsylvania, but that's just me.
Thank you for holding this hearing. My name is Hida Valoria, and I want to say right off the bat that my testimony will be personal, and because of that, it will deal with certain issues of sex and sexuality because of the nature of this, so just to put it out there. I am an intersex person with XX chromosomes, female reproductive organs, and ambiguous genitalia. Unlike most people with these characteristics, however, I never received surgery or hormone treatment. I believe this is because my father is a retired physician. He's a Colombian physician. And at the time and place that he was in medical school, this was not the standardly, he's a bit older to be my father, this wasn't the standardly taught procedure for how to deal with intersex births. However, he did wish to give me estrogen therapy when I hit puberty, and my mother was against the estrogen therapy, and so I never received that ultimately either. The first thing I want to say right off the bat is that I am thrilled and completely overjoyed that I can say this today. When I first hooked up with the intersex movement in 96, I was told by the founder that many of the doctors she had lobbied had told her, well, you say you're unhappy with your surgery. However, if you hadn't had the surgery, you would be much less happy. And hearing that is what basically motivated me to become an activist and speak openly on this topic, because I am a face and a voice to the fact that I'm very happy that I did not have surgery, have always been and continue to be to this day. I think that the entire medical protocol for intersex treatment is based on a misperception that being intersex is at best a detriment, meaning at best called a detriment. More oftenly, it's called a deformity or abnormality, very commonly. And I've had doctors tell me that abnormality is simply a descriptive word because it's not the norm, to which I always point out that it actually is a biased word, because children who are abnormally intelligent or born extremely intelligent or attractive are not deemed abnormal and operated on to reduce this variance from the norm. So it's not an abnormality, it's a variance. I think that's the first huge misperception. Also, the perception that simply it's going to be something that makes the person's life harder. My own life story, basically, I didn't even deal with the issue of being intersex really until college. That's how little an impact it had on me. I knew, but I was familiar with my clitoris. The only time I was raised in a Latino Catholic home, my father is Colombian, my mother's Venezuelan, they both were immigrants, I'm the first American. There was very little talk of sex, very little nudity. And the first time I saw female genitals up close was in a locker room at age 11. And my thought was not that my genitals were different, but that hers were, and that she was missing something. That's literally what went through my mind. And then I didn't have another thought about it until I became sexually active with women in college. At that point, I realized how different my genitals were. I'd like to go back a little bit to say that before this, in puberty, another assumption is that children will be unhappy with their level of femaleness, maleness, or other. And I want to say that I never felt that I wasn't female enough, despite the fact that my breasts didn't develop like many of the other classmates around me, my hips, that I had more muscle mass. This was a perfect fit for my gender identity. Had I been given hormones, I know from how comfortable I am with my body and the level to which it serves me, that I would feel very uncomfortable with large breasts. And I do want to point out that, just while it's on my mind, many people, actually friends of mine who are not intersex and are heterosexual and meet the perfectly quote-unquote normal definition of what it is to be human, have had either breast reductions or breast enlargements. And so they have not been happy, you know, even being non-intersex with their bodies. I actually am happy with my body. The most difficult part of being intersex for me was when I realized that my body was different and my sexuality was different along with that, but I didn't have any education or dialogue or language even behind this. I didn't hear the word intersex until 1995 when I was 27, and at that point I was overjoyed. Rather than being horrified that, you know, I fit into this new minority group, I was extremely relieved that I finally had an identity that matched who I had internally felt myself to be. I felt myself to be different in terms of being more, I wasn't even really a tomboy in terms of the way I dressed growing up, but I seemed more aggressive than other girls. I never thought that this made me a boy. I didn't have that kind of confusion around thinking that I was a boy or wanting to be a boy even. I just felt that I was different, which I know many, many women who fit into that role as well. Once I gained the awareness behind being intersex, my life had a very positive turnaround. And as I said, I became an activist. I not only think that it's not an impediment, but I actually think it's been a very positive facet of my life. People talk about the fact that sexually it will have a negative impact, that the person will have a difficult love life, difficulty dating, difficulty having partners. I have never had difficulty with those issues. Throughout my 20s, like many people I know, I kind of searched around looking for love. I've now been in a happy 3-year committed relationship. I also interviewed 3 other intersex persons who, like myself, did not have surgery or treatment growing up, and they all were in happy, healthy, committed, long-term relationships, unlike the people that I met, and I'm not saying that all people who have had surgery, most now that I know, are in happy, committed relationships, but they hadn't had the same psychological trauma and sexual difficulties around being in a relationship that sometimes often accompany the medical treatment model. So it's actually been very positive on that end for me. I even met someone the other day who, unbeknownst to me, was a Republican. And we were speaking about political issues, and she turned out to be a lot more conservative than I am in many different ways. But when the topic emerged of intersex, which she'd never heard of, the first thing she said is, why would they ever do that? Why operate? That's ridiculous. This is a naturally occurring, you know, thing. And what's wrong with it? And she said, she was a hairstylist, and she was saying how she's noticed that a lot of current advertisements have people in them that you can't tell what sex they are, and that she thinks it's quote-unquote hot. So this is a Republican speaking, just to sort of give voice to the idea that it's not the negative thing that warrants this entire treatment model. Somewhere, you know, 50 years ago, someone made the decision that this was going to be a life impediment on people. And that decision has basically remained, despite other social advancements, and is what... I believe it's an enormous misperception, and I think that it's incredibly cruel to use what is basically just a social bias to take away things from infants who obviously do not have any say, or to coerce parents into making the decision or thinking they need to make the decision, as is often the case, and take away things like reproductive capacity. You heard about intersex persons with XY chromosomes and testes that are sometimes made into females because a doctor decides that their penis is too small. Well, some of these people are fertile, and personally, I am not going to have children, although I could, but I think to take that ability away from someone I can't think of anything more blatantly discriminatory than that. It's just taking away a life function, and to take away the life function of a normal functioning sexuality and physiology. I don't know what else to say. I'm rambling. So basically, my main point is that it was not a negative issue in my life. There are many issues that actually had a stronger negative impact, such as racism, for example. and that I strongly advocate on raising a child, male or female, and letting them make the decision as adults. Because certainly, as a child, as I pointed out, it is not an important issue at that age. And there are many medical, physiological reasons why it's actually damaging, as well as psychological, to do these procedures. And if a person wants to do it later, it's very, very simple to do that now and available. And I have not met one person in speaking with easily 100 intersex people who was happy with the surgery they had. So that's, I think that's strong enough testament in and of itself. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Did you have a question? Everybody wants to run away. The applause scatters you.
After finishing, you just
yes, no, no. You got to take your exit stage left. It's very good. But Commissioner Khan has a question for you.
Sure.
Thank you for your very helpful testimony for us. I just wanted to ask, again, you've been speaking personally. Does our society's binary gender categories, do those work for you in your own sense of yourself?
Yes, and that I feel aspects of both. So I guess that's, you know, I used to at a younger age when I think many of us are going through issues around, you know, how attractive are we as people, blah, 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 blah. I was kind of at times not comfortable with the fact that I had both qualities or identified strongly with both qualities, but the more I got involved around my intersex identity, the more that I felt comfortable with that. So it can be an issue, but I think only if, I think it can be an issue for everyone. And that's, I think, what we always forget. I mean, how many people now are having surgery as an adult? How many people are not happy with their body who are not intersex? So I don't, in some way that's related to gender, that's, and specifically to sexual organs. So I'm very comfortable with it now. I really enjoy being able to sort of identify with both masculine and feminine qualities.
Thank you. Sure.
Commissioner Fahey.
Sounds like you were very well adjusted when you were growing up. Now, what was most helpful? What helped you to feel so comfortable with yourself?
I think that both my parents, but my father, and I now wonder if this is in part because he knew, did a big job of trying to foster my self-esteem growing up. I remember it to the point where it was sometimes almost even annoying, you know, okay, I've heard enough about how wonderful I am. So that was very positive. So I think if parents are, you know, willing to love their children and give them, which they should be doing anyway, regardless of intersex or not, that probably helped a lot in keeping sort of a strong core around it. And then later, I think it actually helped me that I did kind of grow up a minority within my neighborhood that I grew up in, and I was a little used to being different all the time, so it wasn't really such, you know, a big deal to think that I'm different. It didn't disturb me, and also some of the positive role models that were out there while I was growing up, sounds kind of silly, but I mean, very, very happy and grateful that there were people like David Bowie and Grace Jones and Patti Smith out there, because they sort of showed, this aspect that I'm speaking about, that it's not a negative thing to be androgynous or, you know, to have aspects of masculine and femininity. It fostered that belief in me. So I think that's probably it, and good friends. Maybe, I don't know if that's...
Commissioner Grigg?
Were you raised with siblings, and if so, how many, and what was it? Were boys, girls, other intersex children, and just briefly whether or not that had any positive or, you know, imposed any difficulties with regard to your, making such a solid adjustment?
Actually, I have an older brother and a younger sister. And, you know, we were all in the dark about each other. I mean, they had no idea I was intersex. I had no idea my older brother was gay. He had no idea I was a lesbian. it kind of illustrates the fact that as children, but even into high school, I don't think that we're worrying about it. Well, we going back in time, I'm no longer a child, but I don't think adolescents or children are worrying about it as much as adults sort of presume that they will be, or as much as adults themselves get preoccupied with it. So no, it was really like not even an issue. Like it, you know, with the siblings or otherwise, as I mentioned, that's the amazing thing. I mean, I found out sort of technically, I knew that my, as I mentioned, my clitoris was larger, but I didn't know I was intersex until I read it in a paper.
Right.
And I was like, wait a minute, this sounds like it's me, but these people have had surgery and I haven't. So is it still me? Like it just, it's almost a testament to the fact that it's not necessarily such a big deal.
Okay,
or doesn't need to be, really.
Briefly following up, you were never told by your parents or others that you needed to conceal or hide, or when you go to gym class, don't let them, you know, see this or that.
No.
It was just not an issue? Is that what you're saying?
That's basically what I'm saying. When I got older, and again, the thing about older, and now you know, have these ideas in your head about what's socially appropriate or not, I do remember in college at times in swim class trying to make sure that girls wouldn't see. Because I didn't know intersex, I didn't know that intersex existed. I had this sort of public misperception that there were hermaphrodites that were completely both male and female, you know, and if I saw them, it would be like half and half. And that's really not the case, as other people have already illustrated. So I was living in this kind of mysterious zone of like, what am I? I'm not sure, but maybe if I let some of the other girls see, I might not be able to stay in the girls' gym class anymore. Like I just wasn't, I wasn't quite sure if it would like kind of kick me out of the club, so to speak. So I sort of made, you know, I did at that time hide it a little bit, but then again, once I found out later, I've since, you know, I mean, I go to nudist beaches like so many other San Franciscans and like I don't really, you know, to places that are clothing optional, and I don't have a problem with that.
Great. Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you very much for coming out tonight.
Okay.
My next speaker card is for Blue. Is that correct? Am I skipping names properly on this, Marcus? Very good.
Hi. I want to thank this commission for recognizing that intersex issues are human rights issues. I also want to say I'm really uncomfortable being filmed, so if people can respect that, I'd appreciate it. My name is Blue, and I'm intersex, and I'm very grateful to not be an IGM survivor, although the kind of abuse I did experience, I feel, is very symbiotic with that practice and with the concealment model that Thea talked about so well in general. My family targeted me for sexual abuse on the basis of my bodily difference. My earliest memory is of being about two when they stripped me and interrogated the meaning of my genitals. I was too young to understand the social significance of my anatomy, but I got the message that I was a freak. And that shame, not my body, but that shame is what made me an easy target. When my brother molested me, he could force compliance by threatening to tell my secret at school. Being discovered at school, which did happen, meant ridicule and death threats in my locker and a group of boys who wanted to know the truth about me and found it out by dragging me into their bathroom and assaulting me. Meanwhile, my body wasn't maturing typically. But I loved it exactly the way it was. It made other people anxious, so my family fed me what they called vitamins. The only acknowledgement came years later when my mother sent me a book on the dangers of synthetic estrogens. If there was a legitimate medical concern, I'll be the last to know. That betrayal was a small part of a very large pattern of secrecy. When I was a preteen, a doctor treating scoliosis told me that I'd never be able to have children because I was too small. I was confused by that. I knew people much smaller than me who'd had children. And I asked questions, which were responded to with a condescending smile and a pat on the head. When I was 19, I found out a so-called expert in intersex who asked me if my parents kept me so small because they wanted me to be a girl, all with the assumption that there had been engineering going on. He believed I was really a boy and put me on testosterone, which I took because I believed it would reverse the changes estrogen had made, which, of course, nothing will ever do. When he examined me, I wondered what century it was. He poked and prodded at me. He murmured about how extraordinary my body was. He made me feel like a specimen. He did, though, give me lab results from hormone testing, which was a first in terms of communication and being allowed access to my own records. I've repeatedly sent to Kaiser for my childhood records to get more information because I don't even know what diagnosis I have. And I've routinely received no reply from them. I've paid money to get my records. I've called. I've received nothing. And also, when I do seek medical care, which is a last resort for me, doctors will focus on my sex and my status no matter what I'm there for, whether it's the flu, a sinus infection. It doesn't matter. All that they're interested in is my genitals and my gonads. This happens here in San Francisco, in the Progressive Bay Area, in HMO offices, in queer-friendly clinics, in trans clinics, where I've actually had a doctor call me hermaphrodite and all but salivate at the chance to examine me. And I was there because I had an upper respiratory infection. When I had a work-related arm injury, an RSI, a nurse practitioner pulled me aside on my last day of treatment with her and asked me to promise that I would go have my gonads removed because she thought they were precancerous. Now, this woman had only ever examined my arms, neck, and back. I don't know how she knew, because I sure didn't tell her. If I were uninformed, though, I might have taken that, and I might have survived my childhood intact, only to be misled into surgery now. And if there is a legitimate medical reason I need it, no one's telling me that. When I do have problems that actually require attention to my more private parts, I'm too scared to get treatment, because where can I find a doctor who will treat me with dignity, be honest with me, and know enough about a body like mine to help me? That's actually the case now, and I'm having a very hard time finding treatment. Now, I know that hospitals in this area regularly perform IGM and regularly conceal important pieces of information from intersex patients, and clearly I want to drive home that the most pressing concern in that is its direct effect on the people who are often babies and very young children who are mutilated. I also do want to point out the context it creates of compromised rights for intersex patients in general, and by extension, compromised rights in general. I want to talk about the argument for IGM and other normalizing procedures that are cosmetic and not medically based, the argument that intersex people suffer socially if they're not altered surgically and normalized. I would not have been better off mutilated. I wasn't hurt because my body is different. I was hurt because people hate and fear that difference. The concealment model and normalizing perpetuate that fear and perpetuate that hate, and only reinforce the lie that there's something shamefully wrong with a difference, with a body that's different like mine. I want to ask the HRC to listen to that. There are patterns. Our stories are really different. Intersex covers a lot of different conditions and a lot of different lives. And, you know, my family circumstances may be specific, but I want you to listen for the themes, because there's a vicious cycle. It's fear and ignorance that beget shame and abuse and concealment that beget more fear and ignorance. And what it amounts to is a severe breach of human rights. and I won't run away if anyone has questions.
First of all, let me just say thank you, and obviously that was difficult for you to do, and we appreciate the eloquence with which you did it. Also, so you know, the TV camera went to back, so
thank
it
you.
Was to honor your wishes there, and I appreciate everybody who took care of that when it was asked for. Are there any questions from the commissioners? The one question I would ask, do you think I don't want to delve unnecessarily into your relationship with your parents, but I'm just trying to get a sense of this. Do you think if your parents would have had the sort of support and information that we've sort of talked about as lacking, that your situation could have been better as a child, that your parents could have handled this a little differently?
I should certainly hope so.
Yeah.
I don't know what happened when I was born. I don't know whether I was diagnosed, whether my family noticed before a doctor noticed I was different. I mean, I frankly have a really shattered memory mm-hmm. from my early life, and mm-hmm. I don't know.
Right.
But I should certainly hope that it could not have made things worse.
Right. And I guess I kind of knew the answer to that question, and I sort of asked it in the hopes of just providing some encouragement that, city commissioners telling people, one of the shortcomings of this job is you realize how unpowerful you are the minute you take it. We can try to change the world, and that helps. But the reality is that people like you telling personal stories is what's going to change the world. And your story is very powerful. And I would suspect, and I would hope, that if your parents had more information, and that if the doctors around had more information and so forth and so on, that things would be dealt with better. And the way that we're going to get to a situation of more information, even before we take positions on what's right and what's wrong, you got to have an informed dialogue. And the way we're going to get to that is people reinforcing how important it is that information be out there. And that's something you're doing tonight, and I would just encourage you to keep doing it.
If I could respond to that, I would really like to. I think that what would have made a really big difference is that part of my problem was that I couldn't tell anyone, not only because incest survivors feel that way, but because of what it was about. Who could I go to and say that I was a freak?
Right.
So I feel that in a larger social climate where, I hear that doctors say that they do this to make it easier for kids, and many of them mean to make it easier for kids so that the stuff that happened at school to me wouldn't happen. But they have there's an institutional end to change that, to change society. I mean, what happens medically is part of society. And if that's the institutional foundation, I believe it is, of a lot of this kind of bigotry, it's a great place to interrupt it.
Right.
And I believe that that's the place to start interrupting it, and that in a climate like that, it would be harder for, I just wouldn't have been as much of a freak. It wouldn't be accepted to treat me that way.
Thank you very much for coming down.
Thank you.
My fellow commissioners are not leaving. They are just going to the secret commissioner bathroom back there. How's that for embarrassing them? David Cameron. David, how are you?
These things are never tall enough.
Yes.
I'm doing okay.
Good. Last time David and I saw each other was 8 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday.
And you had shorts on.
And I had shorts on. thanks for noticing.
My name is David Cameron. When I began puberty in 1960, I didn't develop like other boys and was taken to our family doctor. He didn't do any tests, but assured my parents that I would develop normally and be able to have children. At 15, I grew to be 6'9", and my not really palpable testicles stayed the same as when I was born. In my 20s, I grew breasts, which I really liked, was diagnosed as sterile and as having XXY sex chromosomes or Klinefelter syndrome, as Dr. Baskin referred to those screwed up chromosomes. It's ironic that in our culture obsessed with one man and one woman can only get married to produce children, that one out of every 400 male births is an XXY baby that is destined not to reproduce. I told the doctor that my only complaint was a low sex drive. He prescribed 300 milligram testosterone injections every 2 weeks for the rest of my life. I was told my shoulders would broaden, I'd gain weight, and if I had any other questions, to consult a medical library. My gender identity was never discussed. My medical records state that my follicle-stimulating hormone level was over twice that of a castrated postmenopausal person. In my 30s, my body became very different from the one I had grown accustomed to and really liked. I went through puberty again, and to my disgust, got very hairy everywhere. My prostate grew so large, I had to start taking medications to urinate, and to my horror, I started to go bald. From the high level of testosterone I was injecting, I became sexually active and contracted the AIDS virus. Testicular implants and breast reduction surgery were advised, but I refused. Had I known any of this beforehand, I would have settled for a low sex drive. It took me 15 years to meet another person with Klinefelter syndrome when I heard about a support group. The leaders were parents of an XXY child, and they also happened to be Mormon. Their advocacy doctors referred to Klinefelter syndrome as an endocrine disorder, an abnormality that could be fixed. The magic cure for them was to normalize with testosterone therapy. Oh, thank you. In one of their newsletters is an advertisement for an investigational testosterone gel study for adolescents with delayed puberty. It's only for children 13 to 17 years old because doctors and drug companies know that parents, not children, give legal consent until age 18. I think it crucial that intersex persons of all gender identities get adequate information about the negative side effects of sex hormones, including their potential cancer risks. This could be accomplished with appropriate counseling and support groups for the patient and family. Only that individual can make an informed decision about using sex hormones, not the parent or the doctor. I felt deceived by my doctor when I wasn't told the truth, the whole truth, even as an adult. Thank you.
David. Anyone have any questions for David, who I might add is a member of our LGBT advisory committee this term? Thank you very much for serving on that. Pleasure to appoint you to it. Okay. Thank you very much. Peter Trinkle from Berkeley.
So the mic goes down here.
That's good. We'll let you know if we can't hear you.
Okay. Thank you. I'd just like to start off by saying thanks for having this hearing, and thanks for taking your time to listen to the testimony. My name is Peter Trinkle. I'm an intersex person. When I was growing up, my parents were very secretive about my being intersex. The topic was only mentioned in passing and with great embarrassment. I found out from my mother that I was born with a vaginal opening but lacked internal female organs. I had cosmetic genital surgery to close the vaginal opening. I sent away for my medical records to the hospital where I was born but they cannot find my old medical history. My primary care physician at Oakland Kaiser has examined my genital scars, but there is not much he can say about events that took place 50 years ago. From the earliest age, I knew I was intersex. Once, when I was about 6 years old, I fell while playing and was knocked unconscious. When I regained consciousness, I found my little brother and his friend had lowered my pants to examine my genital scars. After scolding my brother, he confessed that my parents had pressured him never to reveal my secret. After word apparently spread through my brother's friend, I was repeatedly bullied at school. And schools are a big problem with growing up intersex. I remember getting my head slammed into a metal gate by a couple of guys, and the abuse continued on and on. I could not complain about the continued bullying because of the intense shame and secrecy with which intersex people are regarded. It was impossible to talk to either my parents or school officials about the abuse. Even though my parents would not talk to me openly about my situation, it was apparently known by a surprisingly large number of people. For instance, at the age of 7, I was not allowed to join the Cub Scouts. The basic message that I got was that I was a freak and that I should not exist. When I was about 11 years old and going through puberty, I had gender identity problems. I was pulled from class and had to spend an hour a day sitting in the guidance counselor's office, and I was sent to the local children's hospital. There they did testing on me, but even then they never really told me what was going on. However, not every encounter around being intersex was bad. Once at summer camp when I was about 11, another intersex kid approached me and wanted to talk about his hypospadias. When I asked him why he was interested in talking, he replied that he'd asked my brother about me and found out from him that I was also intersex. I wish that genital surgery had not been done on me. Every person is more than their genitals, and to believe that one can treat intersex people through genital surgery is extremely short-sighted. Evolution created sexual diversity, but society often wants to deny it. I'm not totally against doctors. I was also born with a hip problem and was placed in a full body cast. Complications led to the failure of the first full body cast, and I was left with massive scarring on my left leg due to ulceration. I can accept those scars. It is the scars that were meant to hide who I am that I resent. Many surgeries performed on intersex people are for the purposes of sexual assignment and the visual normalization of the appearance of our genitals. I am opposed to genital surgery, which is not medically necessary when performed on intersex people without our informed consent. I have often felt lonely and isolated in my life. Much of my loneliness had its roots in the systematic denial of the reality of intersex lives. Although there are millions of intersex people in the world, I was made to feel like I was the only one. Today, organizations like the Intersex Society of North America, bodies like ours, and the Intersex Initiative are working to break the cycle of shame and secrecy surrounding intersex lives. I am a board member of bodies like ours. Only a few years ago, I could never imagine that there would be a public hearing on intersex rights held in my lifetime. I'd like to thank the Human Rights Commission for holding this historic hearing. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Any questions? See, the minute people stay at the podium, then there's no questions. That's the way. But you run away, we got to chase you with questions. It's part of our nature up here.
Yeah, well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Trinkle. Commissioner Grigg, see, the minute he ran away, you have a question.
It was a question
that I direct and throw out there, but and you may not have a response, but it's really for our discussions going forward as well. We're hearing a beginning this developing theme about the schools and how important the school experience is in people's overall experience. And so part of what we might think about is how we can, what recommendations or what types of things would be most important in trying to protect those who, you know, are children now and children in the future in the school environment, because there's certainly the medical community, there's the psychiatric community, there's a bunch of different places, but it seems as if the schools is a place that is, you know, that we're hearing repeatedly needs some information and some work.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for asking. Growing up intersex for me, the school was the big hell. And I think that you'll find that most public schools in San Francisco do have intersex students. There's the frequency is large enough that probably every public school in San Francisco has intersex students. So I don't have a specific recommendation, but it's a problem I thought about a lot. And I think it's important for the existence of intersex people to be somehow acknowledged by the school system in a way that when abuse and beatings and other things like that happen, that there's some mechanism where a child can go and seek help.
Absolutely. Well, and one of the thoughts that comes to mind is part of, I know for the public schools, there's always an aspect of diversity training. You know, so I don't even think that intersex issues are even on the radar screen, although I could be wrong. I don't know one way or the other. But certainly these ideas need to, you know, be, you know, maintained so we can try to figure out how to bring them to application in an effective way.
Sure, you said it very well. I appreciate that. Yeah, no, it's something that has to be looked at.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Commissioner Del Portillo?
Yeah. What I have, I'm having a little bit of difficulty sort of framing in my own mind. On the one hand, one does not want to identify a child publicly in a school environment that is certainly not presently supportive or ready to accept people that they can't categorize. On the other, the adults that deal with children need to be obviously educated. And I'm not talking about their being able to talk the talk. I'm talking about really educated, understanding, accepting, etc. I don't see right now, most honestly, I don't see us having a simple answer or even being able to make specific recommendations that would be taken seriously by the institutions that need to be involved, your public schools, your teachers, your counselors, and so on. I served on the Board of Education for two terms. And I remember when the discussion on just whether or not condoms would be available, never mind, we're not talking about anything else, just make them available. Mm-hmm. I mean, it went on and on and on. It was absolutely incredible. When finally one of the parents got up and said, look, it's very simple. Do you want your child's punishment for being sexually active to be death? If you don't want that to be it, then you have to, it's going to happen, so you have to have condoms available. So if the issue of just making condoms available, not giving them to them, not pushing it or not, just making it available, if that's a big issue, folks, we're very far away from really being able to address an issue as sensitive, as complicated, as necessary, as urgent for the common good or for the common, for the healthy well-being and growing up of our children. What is missing for me is where does one start with our reality? Not where does Carlota del Portillo want it to go or how fast, but where do you really start to bring this into the arena of discussion, understanding, and putting forth the recommendations that at first may seem very simple and not progressive or aggressive enough, but the ones that have to begin, because you have a tremendous mass of people that you have to bring into the discussion, into the advocacy, and into the solution, because they bring up our children.
Well, I appreciate you saying what you said, because, you know, with your experience with schools and everything, you know a lot more about how difficult it is to do something in that arena. It's just as an individual, I found
like school was just a big mess as an intersex child. And I know it's not easy because, you know, there's parents, the teachers, guidance counselors, students, and lots of other factors involved. And so it's a big thing to, you know, try to address it. But it's, I wish that just we lived in a culture where the existence of intersex people was not such a subject of shame and secrecy, where it's like, it would be like to be okay to be intersex. It wouldn't be like the end of the world. You wouldn't get beaten up all the time. So, you know, just, I don't know, just, I don't really have an answer, but I'm glad that you've, you know, are thinking about that. Thanks.
Thank you.
Commissioner Patton.
Good evening. Thank you for coming. I have a question to ask you. If you think that it would be valuable to have some sort of psychosocial support developmentally for youth that are intersex. And a second question is, what do you see that this commission could do to support the efforts against discrimination?
I think that psychosocial counseling, in other words, counselors, people who are, you know, professionally in the schools and, you know, hospitals and other community services. I mean, I know ISN is talking about a new model of patient-centered versus the old model of concealment. And so I think there's new ideas out there about how to deal with these things. And I think that probably talking to, like, ISN or bodies like ours, you know, contacting those organizations, they might be able to give you more input on the answer to that because, you know, they probably thought about it a lot more than I have, you know. So. Thanks.
Okay. Candid response. That's appreciated. Thank you very much, Mr. Tringle.
Okay, thank you.
Next speaker is Eli Say and Bessa Queenie.
Good evening. So I was told to make it 3 minutes, so I wrote this 3-minute version. There are things that I cannot explain in 3 minutes, not just the operations, but growing up, feeling like my body was wrong, and not just wrong, but so shameful it was a secret that even I wasn't told. I think it sounds more simple now than it actually was. I was lied to by my parents and doctors for 30 years. I didn't consciously realize that at the time, but I felt it. I grew up with it. And now I do know. And she's still my mother, and I still have to see doctors, more often than not directly because of what they did to me. My clitoris was operated on when I was less than a year old to reduce its size, and then again for the same reason when I was 10. The most sensitive parts of my body connected to pleasure and sex and relationships cut with a knife and sutured before I was old enough to discover them for myself. I grew up with a scar on my belly. I only knew it was connected to whatever shameful secret I was carrying that I didn't understand. I couldn't explain it, so I went to great lengths to hide it all my life. The truth is, I was born with testicles in a body that looked like a baby girl's. I have XY chromosomes. I would have gradually virilized and looked like a man after puberty. When they cut out my testicles at age 10, they took away my chance of ever fathering a child, something that I want very much. They also cut out the hormones my body was naturally producing. They put me on pills that are known to have harmful health effects and told me I had to take them for the next 50 years. I have to pay for doctors regularly for tests and prescriptions. I have to buy these pills that I know are destroying my liver. I'm not obsessively upset about my gender identity, though I do have body dysphoria. I am seething that my perfectly healthy body was so invasively and irreversibly operated on and given hormones and tests and examinations. I remember crying as the doctor put his finger in my vagina with my mother holding my hand. I don't know how to deal with my feelings about being castrated and sterilized for no good reason. All perfectly legal and at the hand of the experts. Standard practice. I want my own natural body back, and I want my childhood back. I want to grow up again without the shame, the secrets, the lies, the confusion, depression, anorexia, anxiety, insecurity, panic attacks, low self-esteem, explosive anger, lack of trust, and feeling of safety. I want my 20s back again, all the time I wasted just trying to figure out who I was and what was going on. The relationships that strained and broke with the mess of confusion and challenges from the repercussions of all this. Even the feelings I grew up with don't go away just because I understand them now. They took the integrity of my body. They took my trust. In my bad moments, I feel like a living experiment, damaged, reconstructed, undesirable and unlovable. I cannot forgive any of this. The truth is that I was never sick. There was absolutely nothing wrong with me. And
thank you. Thank you very much. Commissioner, questions? The lack of questions should not be interpreted as a lack of response. That's a very moving statement, and we appreciate it. We're also under a bit of a time crunch, so I very much appreciate your coming down tonight.
I just want to ask one very quickly, culturally, geographically, where did you experience all this? Was this here in the United States?
No, this was in Australia.
Okay.
But my understanding from all of my experience of meeting intersex people internationally is that it's absolutely parallel.
Right.
And the whole thing about I feel like there's a sense in which doctors are trying to say that, for instance, surgeries are better or different, and I think that's overstated, and I think as Thea pointed out is not the point about the surgeries getting better or worse or the quality of their technical abilities to shorten clitorises or whatever the crazy things that they're doing, but that it's not something that should be being done at all. It's not something that needs to be done for any health reason. It shouldn't be a medical procedure, however technically well it's done, and the whole thing about that.
Commissioner Norman?
Was that?
I've been trying to figure out what to say, because from the beginning of the hearing and listening to the testimony of everyone's experience, I have been just so totally moved by your power, by your strength, that all of you could have gone through the incredible unjust kinds of experiences and still come out the other side and saying, I'm here, I'm able, I'm competent, and here we are. We're not asking for much, just, you know, listen to what we're saying. I have been extremely educated tonight. I've been involved in the sexual minority community in San Francisco for about 35 years. But this is different, and I think that when Marcus opened the hearing, he was saying this is different from LGBT kinds of concerns and problems, only to a point, because what I experience is that people are so afraid of sex and sexual identity and sexual orientation and sexual that none of this could have been discussed openly in a way that was going to support the development of a human being. And so what's lost is that we are all human beings no matter what. So what I want to say is how much I appreciate your ability to stand before us today and tell us these intimate things so that we have a notion of, like, what you experience, so we can hopefully come up with some ideas in how we might be able to support you, not only here in California, but certainly how do we, you know, start that domino effect of dealing with people's bigotry. Yeah, I mean, that's what it also comes down to. So I have not asked very many any questions, because these handouts have been totally incredibly educational. I don't think you all got what we got, but doesn't leave a whole lot of questions to be asked except in a very personal way. So I really want to thank you for your willingness to come and talk to us and to give us all of this information and energy.
Thanks. I want to say that I really wish that I didn't have, I really wish that I didn't have to do it. I hope that people don't have to do it in the future, and that's why the people that have come today, I think a lot of the people that have come today have come so that in 10 years' time or 20 years' time, people don't have to do that. People don't have these stories, and that is the point. And I think that this commission, we're here today because, I'm here today because I feel like you have a place to be able to do something quite strongly about this stuff that's going on that's different than what is being done at the moment by the groups of intersex people and parents and the community. This is an official government body, and I think that you're in a place to be able to do something quite important, to make a very public institutional governmental statement, to make recommendations that would, I think, not just be in effect in this county, but have international reverberations coming from such a credible and recognized body. And that's what I would like to ask in return for what we've brought here today.
Thank you. I have listed as the final speaker before our recess, I guess we'll call it, is Suji Tamar Mattis. Tell me I got that right, and I'm batting 1,000. Oh, that's great.
Perfect. Thank you very much. Hi, my name is Suji Tamar Mattis. I'm intersexed, I'm a parent, and I'm a medical student. As an intersex person, I have been discriminated against in many ways. I just want to tell you about this one very... In looking at all the other things we've heard tonight, it's kind of a mild situation, but it's very indicative of like how intersex people can't even get basic medical care. When I was a young adult, I had a very severe eczema outbreak, and I went to the UCSF emergency room. And, you know, they put me in one of those little thin hospital gowns, and they put me in a room, and I was very sick. I was running a fever. I was pretty out of it. And it took me a little while to realize that there had been at least 20 doctors who'd come in, and each come in, and they'd opened up the gown, and they'd looked over my entire body, and then they'd walked out. And not one of them had offered me any medical help. And I realized that my need for medical assistance at that time was very secondary to their need for, well, actually their voyeuristic desire of every intern and resident in that hospital to come and see an intersex person. Almost every intersex person I know has a very similar story to tell. You've heard of some of them tonight. Experiences like these create barriers to access to health care for intersex people. Objectification of intersex people is not the only problem. As a medical student, I've learned that it is illegal to selectively abort a male or a female child on the basis of the parent's preference for gender. It is, however, perfectly legal and common to abort an intersex child purely on the basis of their intersex status. Even when our sex babies escape selective abortion, they typically face the non-consensual surgeries that we've all heard about tonight. In medical school, we're taught that medical treatment should be based on scientific evidence. There's no research to demonstrate that intersex babies benefit from these cosmetic genital surgeries. In a few weeks, I will start my clinical training here in a hospital in San Francisco. And as I'm getting ready to do this, I'm thinking about this call I got. I got this call right when I started medical school 2 years ago. It was from a nurse who worked in a pediatric hospital, or a pediatric ward of a hospital. And she was caring for a newborn intersex baby. The parents, of course, were being told that the baby needed to have genital surgery. And she knew that the purpose of the surgery was cosmetic and had no other actual use, except to make the baby look more normal and easier for the parents to deal with and for the doctors to deal with. She wanted to inform the parents of their other options. However, she knew that she would be risking her job if she contradicted the established protocols. As I began my clinical training, I fear that I might face a similar dilemma, even here in San Francisco. I know that I couldn't silently stand by in such a situation, and yet that speaking up could end my career. The job of protecting these babies should not fall on isolated nurses and medical students. You all have the power. You have the power to implement anti-discrimination law and to stop the unnecessary mutilation of intersex babies, at least here in San Francisco. As an intersex person, as a medical student, and as a parent, I'm calling on you to please use that power and to stop these surgeries from happening here. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much for coming down. Marcus, are we to take a break now?
We are. Commissioner Heineke, a 10-minute break.
Yeah, what I would suggest is that we will keep it to 10 minutes and that I will start this meeting back up in 10 minutes, maybe even a bit sooner. So I would ask everyone if they plan to come back to stay in the area. I know the bathrooms are right out here. Is there anything else I need to announce for this break?
There's some light refreshments and drinks outside for people to partake
wow.
in. Hopefully the commissioners will get there too.
Hopefully the commissioners will get there first. In the break, we talked about a few modifications to the agenda here just so that we could get things moving because we do have a time crunch and I do have a few commissioners who need to leave shortly, and I want to make sure they're here as long as possible. So let's skip ahead as we discuss to the issue of informed consent and our three speakers on that, if that's okay.
That's right. We're going to move into the parents.
What I would suggest to the fellow commissioners is, as you can see from your agendas, we sort of have three blocks of topics: informed consent, medical providers, and resources and education. What I would ask is that we hold our questions on these topics until all three people have spoken so that we can ask our questions at once and be more efficient. Marcus, sorry, I stepped on what you were going
to
say.
That's okay. I just wanted to inform the commissioners that we will be showing this film clip at a very soon meeting soon in the future for your edification. So we're going to start off with the parents and Freema Hillman.
And on that note, I'll just note for the people assembled that this isn't the end of the discussion. This is just one hearing, and this is an ongoing process. So don't feel that if it's not said tonight, it can't be said at all. Ms. Hillman, nice to see you.
My name is Freema Hillman, and thank you very much. Is this on? Thank you very much for having this very important hearing. I first heard the words precocious puberty and virilizing adrenal hyperplasia in 1970, just before the birth of my daughter, Thea. I was teaching a grade 2 class, and one of the students, Michael, was problematic. He was extremely bright and well-mannered, yet at times his behavior seemed out of his control and inappropriate for a child his age. At 8 years old, he had the beginnings of facial hair. His mother told me that he had a condition called virilizing adrenal hyperplasia. A few years later, when my own child, Thea, was around 4 years old, I noticed that she had a few pubic hairs. That and the fact that at times her behavior seemed uncharacteristically intense in a way that reminded me of Michael absolutely convinced me that my daughter had this same syndrome. Our pediatrician took some tests to put my mind at ease. Although the results were inconclusive, he ruled out the possibility of adrenal hyperplasia, told me to go home and enjoy my daughter, i.e. not to think up any more diseases for her. The next doctor spent about a year testing Thea before diagnosing her with borderline virilizing adrenal hyperplasia. Already, her bone age was advanced by a couple of years. The doctor was unsure exactly what form of the syndrome she had or what treatment would work, thus began years of testing and monitoring medications. The doctor didn't tell me much about her condition. To get further information, the medical library at Alta Bates was my only resource. There was very little material available, but what there was very scary. There were many pictures of naked children with their eyes censored, malformed genitals exposed. All had some form of related syndrome due to a lack of some enzyme called alpha-hydroxyprogesterone 13 or 17 or whatever. I felt sick as the reality of the possibility sunk in. Basically, because of the lack of an enzyme, my little girl had an overactive adrenal gland which produced male hormones, testosterone, an excess of which could lead to an advanced bone age, early puberty, stunted growth, facial and body hair, lesbianism, as well as other masculine characteristics. My mind was whirling. I thought about the circus visit when I was a child. The barker made it sound so exciting. Step inside, see the freaks. I paid extra to see those freaks. I remember well how disappointed and sad I felt when I saw the bearded lady. I can remember looking into her eyes. She looked right back at me. Just a sad lady with a beard. I was horrified about what we might be up against. I needed to talk about it. I was actually ashamed and embarrassed to talk with my friends. When mentioning the syndrome, I dropped the virilizing part and called it adrenal hyperplasia. And I never talked about my greatest fears. My husband didn't want to talk about it because, well, why dwell on something you have no control over? I tried not to pass my fears on to my daughter as we spent years fighting the effects of hormonal imbalance. In retrospect, I was always trying to hide the evidence of who she really was inside. But she always knew. She felt the difference. And fortunately, she held on. As a mother, I wanted my daughter to look normal, to fit right in. Fortunately, in Thea's case, hormone medication was sufficient to keep her growing and looking normal, and I didn't have to face the option of genital surgery to achieve that look of normalcy. Thank goodness I didn't have to make a decision about surgery for her, because it is very clear now that my daughter would not have chosen it for herself. With communication, better communication, and public awareness, I wouldn't have been so lonely, scared, or ashamed in my struggle. My daughter could have known who she was growing up, instead of just feeling different and not understanding why. We would all understand that sexuality is a continuum. And most importantly of all, we would all know that how you are born could never be something to be ashamed of. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hillman. I understand we have written testimony. Is that to be submitted, summarized? How are we going to do that?
Good evening, Commission. This is the testimony for the Human Rights Commission from Ruth Tang, parent. My name is Ren Phoenix. As Mrs. Tang writes, for 9 months, I experienced the most joyful anticipation a young woman can feel. In September of that year, I gave birth to what I believed was a beautiful baby girl. Her grandparents, my husband, and I delighted over the next 10 months of her life, but this all came to an abrupt end after an external examination defined her as, in quotation marks, a true hermaphrodite. My husband and I were shocked and worried to receive such unexpected and unheard of news about our child. In the long term, this was made worse when doctors decided that she should be brought up as a girl, their reason being that surgery to make her into a girl was easier to do than to change her into a boy. So guided by their superior knowledge on the subject, I agreed to allow them to perform, in parentheses, what they deemed to be the necessary surgery. We were given very limited information about this unheard of to most people condition. We were told what needed to be done. We were entirely in the hands of the professionals. There was There were no support organizations and no literature that might have helped us to make a more informed decision. Little did we know then, as we acquiesced to the doctor's instructions, the trauma and the suffering that our decision was going to cause our child and myself. There was no one I could turn to for advice or guidance. The doctor led me to believe that it was such a rare condition that I should have to deal with it alone. He failed to mention that another child was born in the same hospital in the same year with the same condition, which I learned of 30 years later. Perhaps if we had known about each other, the two families could have provided support and comfort to each other during our respective children's development. With virtually no guidance, I watched my child struggle, especially through her teen years, with confusion, pain, shame, and other social-emotional consequences of her experiences. I couldn't help her because I knew so little myself. With what I've learned in recent years, I now know that she could have not had to have the surgery or the hormones until she was old enough to make her own choice based on her own feelings. She's the only one who could have known how she felt inside and what would be best for her to feel whole and complete. Without a doubt, her rights have been violated. Although my suffering is very secondary to my child's, I nevertheless endured 30 years of pain at having to keep my secret from everybody, including her grandparents who died never knowing the truth. I was unaware of the turmoil, emotional confusion, and torment that my child was going through and therefore was not there to help her. I was playing ostrich for many years. When I finally did lift my head out of the sand, I began to suffer excruciating guilt for not giving her the support she needed. Today I live with the guilt of having listened to the doctors, not being informed of other options, and putting my child through the most horrendous emotional and psychological traumas for so much of her life. Signed, Ruth Tang, Cairn Street, Huget, Victoria, Australia. Thank you.
Okay, next we have the written testimony of Debbie Hartman.
Hi, my name is Julie Frank. I'm a member of the LGBT Advisory Committee, and I just want to say thank you all for being here and for taking the time to listen to us tonight. I'm reading for Debbie Hartman, who is a parent. And Debbie writes, I apologize for my absence tonight, but wish to convey my message through this letter. I am the single mom of a 10-year-old intersex child, Kelly. Kelly was surgically reassigned female at the age of 11 weeks. This was after having raised her as Kyle for those 11 weeks. For two of the 11, not knowing for sure, as doctors so harshly put it to me, what the baby was. To explain all of this to you without writing a book will be difficult, but I will try to do my best. My child has undergone 4 genital surgeries to try to make her genitals look cosmetically female. I assure you that they do not look correctly female. Not until I did research and continuously demanded answers did I find out that things did not have to go that way. I now know that she has endured unnecessary pain and confusion, severe scarring both emotionally and physically, and as a result battles with who she is every day. She asks why doctors thought they, her genitals, should be any different. Tell me, how does a mother answer that question? The emotional trauma that this has caused for me as a mother is hard to put into words. To see my baby undergo so many surgeries and have the end result not be what doctors led me to believe goes beyond words. My heart also aches at the memories of my own confusion and all the unanswered questions. I feel I was not given whole truths to help me make an educated or informed decision. I now realize it was not really my decision to make. It was Kelly's and hers alone. She does not have any choice but to live with the scarred, less sensitive genitals for the rest of her life. The doctors argued amongst themselves in front of me. Some kept repeating that these children were, quote, better off reared as girls. What did that mean? If doctors didn't know what to do, then who did? This made me constantly nervous, depressed, and anxious. When they came to me in the waiting room to tell me that Kyle, quote, was in fact a girl, they used words that scared me, to make me to make the decision. Cancer, cancer, cancer rang in my head. Wouldn't you sign the papers to do surgery for that too? Also, there is no one, they answered when I continuously asked to speak with others in our situation. It has forever ruined my trust in anyone. To think it would have taken just one person to say to me, you have time, you can wait and then make a decision, or you can raise your child with the genitals it was born with and let him or her decide. That never happened. We must change the treatment of intersex births with a patient-centered protocol. Treat the emotional aspects of raising a child who may one day transition. Help the child to know that no one needs to see their, quote, different genitals, just like anyone should teach their children about their normal genitals. Only when these babies have a real medical emergency should we even consider surgery. These babies were given no choice to keep what God gave them. My baby was given no choice. I was given no choice. We all need to encourage the medical field to rethink how it handles this. It is a must. Kelly and I have lived through it and know what needs to be. People need to be educated about this. There need to be more support networks readily available. Hospitals should have an intersex-educated mental health advisor available immediately when an intersex child is born. I understand that a child must be raised male or female when born intersexed. What I do not understand is why it has become practice to try and change them physically first. My child has tried to commit suicide twice in her 10 little years because she says she hates her body. She constantly asks me why they did this surgery. She is hoping the answer will be different than before. She has lived with shame from an early age because she got the drift of what doctors were saying in the examining rooms. And now, because she knows they cut up her genitals, she has articulated it to me this way. Quote, they thought I was no good, Mom. They scarred me up. I just wanted the little wiener I had, and now I will never have it. This is what people need to think about and hear. Please help in the reform of intersex treatment. I thank you for your time. Debbie Rode Hartman.
Yeah, sure. Can you tell us where Debbie Hartman lives, please? Well, we have Ms. Hillman here, commissioners, if there are questions for parents. The message is pretty clear and sort of explored with some of the other questions. We don't have to ask questions, but if people do have questions for Ms. Hillman, okay, I don't see any lights on my screen. The next topic we have is medical providers, and it's my understanding our first speaker is Dr. Kate O'Hanlon.
While Dr. O'Hanlon is preparing her presentation, I would be happy to move on to Dr. Diamond and read his comments into record.
Thank you, Marcus. That's a good idea.
I've been asked on behalf of Dr. Milton Diamond from the University of Hawaii to read his very brief comments, and you will be receiving the literature to which he references in this letter. To whom it may concern regarding the public hearing on intersex issues, accompanying this letter are several articles that are directly related to the treatment of intersex individuals. I submit them for your consideration that all human rights concerns be extended to those with intersex conditions. Of particular moment is that, number one, no surgery should be done to any person without that person's informed consent. Number two, all individuals should be treated with full honesty. And number three, all persons should be fully informed of their condition and all the options for their treatment. Sincerely, Milton Diamond, PhD, Professor, University of Hawaii, Manoa.
Good evening. My name is Dr. Kate O'Hanlon. I'm a gynecologic cancer surgeon.
and I practice at Sequoia Hospital in Redwood City. What I would like to talk about are the medical issues that we as gynecologists see that relate to the issues of children who are born with ambiguous genitals. I'm not seeing any function yet. Oh, here we go.
Okay. So you know, just so you don't think we're ignoring you, we have this presentation on our screen. So if you see us looking down at these black boxes, we're actually watching the presentation.
Okay. Well, some of my screen is missing on your presentation. Can you give me the grace of 1 minute? I'm sorry about this. Well, regardless, there are four components of human sexuality. It's your orientation, which is to women, or over here it says to men, but there's a spectrum that we know and recognize, and there are bisexuals. There's your gender identity, which is your sense of self, which inside you can feel yourself as to be a man or a woman, and also inside you can say that you fit within that spectrum and you are simply a human and refuse to be categorized on either of the far ends. Intersexual people are individuals whose genital anatomy is in between the spectrum of expressing or looking purely male or, on this side, purely female. If you see in this picture, which is poorly demonstrated on your audio video system, I'm sorry, these are two genitals. This is a boy, this is a girl, both at 11 weeks. And they look startlingly similar, don't they? If the child continues to develop and continue looking exactly as they look at 11 weeks, you will end up with a child with intersexual anatomy. And it is a variant of perfectly normal. You know, I'm not going to be able to show my whole slides, and my slides are important. I'm going to ask for 1 minute to repair this. Do we have?
We have somebody from AV who's working on this.
Oh, they are. It's in my computer, I can tell you. I do because I'm projecting that. We can get to end show. The man.
I am the man.
You're the person. You're definitely the person. It's pretty centered up there.
Yeah.
It's centered now. We're getting it. Yes, thank you. Thank you very much for your patience. All right, so this has shown the spectrums, and every place on these spectrums is normal. That's the important take-home from this picture. All right, so you've heard tonight what the old pattern has done. It talks about assigning gender, and you could be wrong, hiding the truth, which harms everyone, carve it down to make it fit, that, and most of us in this room, even the medical folks, have rejected that. or remove it, make it look right, fix the damage that you did later. Today what we're seeing is assign the gender, stay open, and you heard from Dr. Baskin, carve it down if it's unusually large and do make a vagina from the colon. But let me reassure the commission that the least important thing for an infant, a toddler, a child, and preschool, an adolescent is having a clitoris or a vagina that looks nice. These are not priorities for the baby. These are concerns that the parents may have, but the genital anatomy will evolve normally. So what we're saying is to take what Dr. Baskin had mentioned to what Dr. Milton Diamond from Hawaii has been advocating, and it is being recognized across the United States by many institutions, but the pediatric urologists have been stunningly slow to recognize this really important human rights issue of the child. So we are suggesting our future suggestions are to operate on no one without consent, to get quality data from the surgeries. Dr. Baskin does not have follow-up surgery like he alleged that he did. I would ask this commission to require that he produce it, because it does not exist that shows that adults who have had clitorectomies or clitoroplasties, as they are done in the last 10 years, they do not have follow-up data to show that it's structurally, functionally normal, or that the quality of life of these individuals has been improved over the observational management style of helping the child, helping the family, and then letting the child, after puberty, decide what surgery they may want or need. Now, there is research, however, that shows that many adult intersexuals, as you have seen, and this is research, this is peer-reviewed, this is not a number of concerned individuals who have been collected by activists to speak to a commission. This is peer-reviewed literature. Both of them are important, though, may I add. Many adult intersexuals are dissatisfied with their treatment by the patient, by their parents and by their doctors, and you've seen they've been made to feel abnormal, inadequate, and stigmatized. They're dissatisfied specifically with the results of their surgeries because of appearances, scarring, and it is causing pain for many, or diminished function, or absent function. Adult women do not complain about having a large clitoris, as you have seen. Adult men do not want to have their microphallus removed and be raised as a girl. These children will still declare themselves to be a boy within 2 to 4 years, and then have to transition as transgender individuals once they have their own autonomy. Adult men with small phalluses can and do learn to be sexual in ways that satisfy both themselves and their partners. In the peer-reviewed literature, we see that the results of clitoroplasty are, frankly, very disappointing. The girls with vaginoplasty required repeat surgeries over and over again to fix an organ that they would never use until their late teens at the earliest, or mid-teens, let's say. The clitoroplasties were unsatisfactory with atrophy, and look at the small numbers of follow-up. And this is the best research that we're getting. Ethical considerations in surgery, then? Parents and doctors may not make the correct decision for the child's long term, and you've seen that tonight. Parents do want security. They want the best for their child, but surgery does not provide that, as you've seen. Science, safety, ethics, honesty, efficacy should all be the priority of any treatment offered by a qualified institution. All the same options, surgery and medical, are open to the child, the adolescent, the teen, the young adult, when they are able to give consent. Ethical considerations of surgery, then. By operating on a child for cosmetic reasons, and I'm talking specifically about reducing the size of a clitoris on a baby, this is unnecessary surgery. It violates the standards of patients' rights and autonomy. It risks her future sensation, urinary function. It can risk, not clitoroplasty risking fertility, but vaginoplasty can risk fertility. And it can cause harmful effects on their genital appearance when it's done on an infant without a confirmed cause. It violates every medical standard of informed consent because it doesn't benefit the patient, and they are not provided with the information of alternatives. They can't because they're infants. So reasons to delay surgery until puberty, when the child can say, yes, I'd like to have it. please. My penis is larger, or my phallus, my penis is smaller, my clitoris is larger than I would like it to be. You get consent and buy-in by the patient and not this history that you've seen tonight of remorse, regret, and mistreatment. You have already undergone, the child has already undergone growth and expansion, and so the anatomy is larger, it's more easily operable, and the results are more likely to be guaranteed. But understand that I just said more likely to be guaranteed. We don't have long-term data on clitoroplasties in adults either. Women, as I mentioned, do not mind having a large one. If a child becomes male at puberty or desires gender reassignment, the gland, that should say gland, no, they will be glad it was not cut or carved on. All right, now the Nuremberg Code of Ethics says you may not do anything to a human being, a prisoner, or someone in your charge that's not medically necessary, particularly if it's irreversible and potentially harmful. You've seen evidence of this tonight. There is no proof of efficacy or benefit in the long term. There is no medical consensus about this. And there is evidence of harm, as you've seen tonight, to many. Medical intervention in the unconsenting person is not allowed, according to the Nuremberg Convention. It violates children's legal rights and the surgical consent ethics. Parents are allowed to consent their minor children to undergo medically necessary procedures, but not when the treatment alleviates no pain or illness, not when the rationale is speculative or psychosocial, and not when it's irreversible and potentially harmful. The irreversible outcome may deprive the child of the right to determine their sexual experience, their sexual future, their very private future, and their own sexual identity when they are old enough to do so. Operating on a child violates the UN Commission on Human Rights when you do so for cosmetic reasons. We are all upset about female genital mutilation when it goes on in African tribes, yet they think it's culturally essential. Female genital mutilation violates their bodily integrity and their personal dignity and their autonomy. Operating on an infant for cosmetic reasons with no proven benefit also violates the American Convention on Human Rights and the American Pediatric Association's own standards. Parents do not have the right to disregard the child's intrinsic human rights to privacy, dignity, autonomy, and physical integrity by altering their genitals through these irreversible surgeries that are unproven and are associated with controversial psychosocial and aesthetic rationales.
That's the position of the American Pediatric Association, or you're saying it violates and then this is your position?
This is the American Pediatric Association's words, and the pediatric urologists still are doing these procedures. It violates the United States ban. I mentioned that. So suggested management for intersexuality: do not operate on the infant clitoris or remove a phallus. Do not remove a potentially functional gonad. Do not perform a vaginoplasty on a child until requested after puberty. Suggestions for each medical institution on how they will organize the management of intersexuality within the institution. Ask every institution to create an ethics panel to review the current literature. The literature is there that I'm quoting to you. And generate a policy based on that literature. This is not radical. This is not left of center medicine. Generate a policy about intersexual issues and surgeries. Prohibit gonadectomy, clitoral, vaginal surgery on any child without the ethics panel review. This is all we're asking. And require follow-up studies on all of these children because they do not exist. So my suggestions to this panel are that you require that Dr. Baskin provide this commission with the, quote, abundant follow-up data that he has referred to that supports the performance of clitoral reduction on little girls or vaginoplasty in terms of satisfactory structure and function or quality of life outcomes. Require an institutional ethics panel to be formed that will review the literature and create institutional policy regarding gonadectomy, clitoroplasty, vaginoplasty by all San Francisco institutions which credential surgeons to perform this procedure. require follow-up data regarding the quality of life outcomes from the procedures that are performed in these institutions. And then lastly, to prohibit, we're asking the San Francisco Human Rights Commission to prohibit gonadectomy, clitoroplasty, and vaginoplasty on all infants and children without a formal hospital institutional ethics panel review in all the hospitals under your auspices. Thank you.
Dr. O'Hanlon,
questions.
Again, I feel like I'm getting more than one story here. You're telling me that the standard, or we'll call it the standard set by the American Pediatric Association, is sort of against surgery.
Yes.
Dr. Baskin tells me that, you know, his institution has performed maybe one surgery a year, and that his general practice and the gold standard followed by his colleagues around the nation, according to him, is surgery is really a very uncommon thing. It's sort of a wait and see. Let's go about it. I'm hearing from lay people and now from you that that may not be the case. Okay. Why, if the American Pediatric Society says this is how we do it, why, if Dr. Baskin says it's a gold standard, are surgeons still performing these surgeries?
The belief is that they are helping these children by making them look more normal. They believe they are following the standards of the American Pediatric Association. These are good doctors who think they're doing a good deed for the infants and the parents.
So they think they're actually in compliance with that standard that you put up on the – explain that to me. I mean, I'm not – if they say they think they're helping the parent and the child, that's one thing. Let's just put that aside. But how can that act be viewed as compliance with those words of that standard?
Well, there are different priorities. If you think that the most important thing for a little girl is to have a vagina and you can provide one, then you'll do it. If you think it's really important for a toddler to have a vulva or phallus that looks like all the other kids in the classroom, then you'll provide it. If the parents are worried and upset and scared and don't know where to go, and your surgery can create for the short term a picture that you think creates a favorable picture for this child, then as a surgeon you'll do it.
Right. So the point is that this standard really isn't much of a standard. It's got enough float in it that doctors or parents can read it to be whatever they want it to be.
Correct. And Dr. Baskin reports that he would do a clitoroplasty for a large clitoris. We didn't talk tonight about vaginoplasty, the insertion of a segment of a colon behind the urethra where a vagina might have grown. But that's a procedure that's also done on some children who do not have a vagina. And the follow-up data on that is, the small amount of follow-up data that's available is dismal. And the follow-up and the long-term follow-up data is absent. And most of these children will anecdotally tell you that they require multiple corrective surgeries as well.
Would you agree that the trend is away from surgery, but that the trend is not going quick enough, or is do you
absolutely
think?
And Dr. Baskin represents the thinking that you've heard tonight. I mean, I think that he espouses probably 90% of what you've heard tonight. We're taking it the other 10%.
I see. Okay.
I'm sorry. Would you say that again?
Dr. Baskin, his beliefs about being open with the parents, open with the children. He talked about giving the children or delaying all inessential surgery, but then he did talk about doing a clitoroplasty, a reduction of the size of a large clitoris. And we disagree with that. I think that the standards in medicine, if applied meticulously, disagree with that. There are a lot of traditions in medicine that are followed, and when you question why or how did we keep doing that or why did we ever start, it started with good intentions, but the data didn't support it.
Right.
It used to, you know, I mean, originally the belief was that all children born with ambiguous genitals should have the microphallus or clitoris removed so that they could all be raised as little girls. And in fact, what becomes more important, or what was learned, was that no, it's the exposure of the brain in the uterus during the first 12 weeks that makes the sense of boyness or girlness, that gives the sense of orientation as well. And whatever happens to the genital development after that doesn't actually correlate all the time, as you've seen, with what happens inside the fetal brain. And, you know, doctors always act like we're the authority on everything until we learn differently. And we have walking experiments that were never registered in an institutional review protocol that is required today for the standard of medicine. In other words, to do a new surgery, to do an unproven surgery, or to innovate in surgery, you have to request approval from an institutional board called the Investigational Review Board. The surgeries done on the individuals who have spoken tonight were never reviewed by an Investigational Review Board. The follow-up data on whether the microphalluses work or the clitorises, macro clitorises work, has not been provided. And so, you know, under standards today, none of these surgeries could be approved, but they are traditions in medicine. So we are all asking to apply the standard of surgery that's used today for all other surgeries. When I do a hysterectomy, I know it will benefit the patient this year, next year, and 10 years from now. And I can tell her the alternatives, I can tell her the complications and the side effects. This is not available to the infant. It's not available to the parents considering surgery. It's not available to the toddler or the preschool. So we really have to collect the data and then review it with the ethics and IRB panels.
Thank you, Dr. O'Hanlon.
I thank you all for considering this.
Dr. Joan Roughgarden.
Good evening, commissioners. My name is Joan Roughgarden, and I'm a biology professor at Stanford University, where I teach biology, and for many years I've taught pre-meds. And I really can't equal the impassioned accounts you've already heard. And the reason I'm here, actually, is that I've recently published a book earlier this month called Evolution's Rainbow. And the subtitle is Diversity, Gender, and Sexuality in Nature and People. And I was giving a presentation about this in Cody's bookstore just this Monday, and David and Peter from the Intersex Society of North America asked me to come and speak with you. And so I'm a zoologist, and I can indicate something which I hope is helpful. First of all, we in biology are doing a very bad job of teaching our subject, and we are misrepresenting nature to you. And in particular, we are misrepresenting the extent of the male-female binary. The male-female binary is well-defined at the level of the gamete. That is, there's a huge difference between the sperm and the egg. But the mistake is to assume that that dichotomy projects to the level of whole bodies. The whole bodies of individual animals or of individual people doesn't fall into a clear-cut binary just the way the egg and the sperm does. And my book is about a lot of this. For example, even among vertebrates, there are many species of fish. If you go snorkeling on a coral reef, for example, 30% of the fish you see will have changed sex during their lives. And these are vertebrates. These aren't weird worms or something of that sort. And if you get to mammals, for example, there's also no binary in genital architecture. And even some of our closest relatives, the primates, among the females, there are very large clitorises called pendulous clitorises, which are colored and colorful, and genitals are used as signaling organs in primates and mammals. And with respect to chromosomes, even in mammals, the Y chromosome is not necessary for maleness. There are many species in which no males have a Y chromosome. And there are also species of rodents in which all females have ovotestes, which are precisely traits that are highly stigmatized in the discussion we've had here. Now, the question that I'd like to ask you then is, why is medicine so mistaken in its practice and in what it tells parents? And I have to say that we biologists have the blame for this. It has to do with what we teach the pre-meds in the first place, because that's where they pick up these erroneous impressions that they, you know, institutionalize. And so one of my missions as a biology teacher is to make sure that nature shows in our undergraduate curriculum is more accurate than it has been in the past. Now, with respect to concrete recommendations, here's what I would offer. First of all, and this is similar to what Kate was saying in one regard. First of all, I think that any license to practice for an MD here in San Francisco, for a license, it be required that the person take training in diversity in gender, sexuality, and body types. And secondly, that any accredited, that for a licensed hospital in the city of San Francisco, city and county, that there be a list of procedures that the hospital is authorized to conduct. And I think that these are legislative items that could be carried to the Board of Supervisors and fall under the appropriate purview of government regulation, so that we should insist that practicing physicians have the training that admittedly they didn't get during their pre-medical and medical education. So this is remedial in a sense, to bring them up to date. And secondly, make sure that no procedures are carried out in our hospitals which are ineffective in the sense that Kate was mentioning. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. Dr. Naomi O'Keefe.
My name is Dr. Naomi O'Keefe. I'm a licensed clinical psychologist with a private practice in San Francisco, and I specialize in treating couples and individuals with issues of sexual intimacy and sexual dysfunction. I'm also an adjunct professor of psychology at Argosy University, where I teach courses in human sexuality and sexual dysfunction. Both in my professional practice and in teaching, I have had the opportunity to get to know many intersexed individuals personally. I have heard their stories and listened to their frustration and pain at being forced to live with the devastating results of unwanted and unnecessary genital surgery. Even the fact that these surgeries have been done, as you have heard, is often kept secret from intersexed persons, while well-meaning parents and medical personnel attempt to reinforce a gender identity which the intersexed person has not been able to decide for themselves. And I ask you, how many of us here today would want to wake up some morning and discover that not only was our gender identity selected for us without our consent, but that surgery had rendered our genitals permanently disfigured and that we were unable to experience normal sexual functioning? Most persons who have undergone infant and childhood sex assignment surgery, as you have also heard, these persons are unable to experience normal arousal and orgasm. And this has a devastating impact not only on themselves, but upon their partners as well. To date, most professional psychology training programs are woefully inadequate about educating therapists in training about the frequency of this sexual diversity. As you have also heard, one in every 2,000 live births is an intersex baby. therapists and counselors need to be much better informed about this naturally occurring genital diversity and of the suffering caused by the secrecy and shame experienced by the intersex person and their families. Therapists need to be aware of the emotional pain and the sometimes permanent loss of normal sexual functioning caused by these sex assignment surgeries and the realities of additional problems of poor bladder and bowel functioning endured by persons who have undergone these surgeries, again, usually without their knowledge and consent until a much later time. Granted, some genital anomalies do need medical intervention for basic healthy excretory functioning, but to perform surgery routinely on infants merely for cosmetic reasons or because a penis seems too short or a clitoris too long for the comfort and taste of inadequately informed medical personnel and anxious and embarrassed parents is, in my opinion, no different than genital mutilation. The birth of an intersex child is generally not a medical emergency, but in our culture still seems to be a social emergency for which parents and medical professionals are often completely unprepared and uneducated. I believe the concerns and anxieties experienced by new parents of an intersex child would be much better addressed in the following three ways. First, until there are laws and regulations preventing unnecessary infant sex assignment surgeries, obstetricians, gynecologists, surgeons, and pediatricians need to have a more comprehensive understanding of the other options for responding to the birth of an intersex child that do not include a rushed and irreversible surgery. Intersex adults overwhelmingly state that they would not have, that they would have wanted to make any decisions regarding surgery themselves when they are mature enough to clearly identify their felt sense of gender identity and can understand the risks and side effects of such surgeries. Second, training programs for psychologists and counselors should include specific training in addressing the special needs of parents and extended families of an intersex baby. Secrecy and shame surrounding this naturally occurring diversity needs to be eliminated by an open and informed discussion and education. And lastly, I propose that all hospitals in San Francisco, and I wish everywhere, could be mandated to provide new parents of an intersexed baby with a referral list of therapists with special training in the counseling and support of new parents of an intersexed baby. These specially trained therapists would be on call to come to the hospital within hours of the birth to counsel and support new parents of an intersexed baby. And in addition, hospitals should be required to provide new parents with a list of other parents of intersex children who have agreed to make themselves available as consultants during this crucial decision-making time. And in conclusion, I'd like to see laws passed prohibiting all unnecessary infant genital surgery. Such laws should also mandate the consensus of a decision-making team, and this has been mentioned by others as well, to determine if surgery is truly necessary. My proposal for such a team would include the baby's pediatrician, the parents, a counselor for the parents, and absolutely a professional advocate for the baby drawn from the intersex community. Thank you.
Is there a growing group, for lack of a better word, of therapists who are specializing in this area or have expertise in counseling in this area? Because one of the things we heard earlier from, you know, one of the personal accounts, which sort of stuck with me, my father's a psychologist, was that, you know, in the earlier days, there were psychologists didn't even know how to deal with this. They didn't know how to counsel people. Is there becoming a group of therapists who can handle this now?
Sadly, not to my knowledge.
So when you recommend that we have the hospitals within our jurisdiction provide a list of therapists or counselors who could assist, how would we go about developing that list?
San Francisco has a doctoral program, a school which provides a doctoral program in human sexuality. And also there are many professionals who are members of an organization called the Society for the Scientific Study of Sexuality, or QuadS. And many of those people are extremely well-informed and knowledgeable. And that would be one of the first places that I would look. When I teach courses in human sexuality, I always provide a panel on sexual diversity. And I've been lucky enough each time to be able to get a person to come and speak to us from the intersex community. And I'm hoping that as a result, more and more students of psychology will be better informed and more interested in being available to assist and help with these parents and children.
Well, that's something I would encourage, and not just to you, but to the others in the audience here, that one of the ways that we can assist is to, you know, you suggest mandate information dispensal. We can do that. We can or urge the Board of Supervisors to do that, or we can actually do it ourselves on a more voluntary basis. And, you know, to the extent you can work with our staff to provide sort of lists of resources that we can pass along, that's very helpful, because I think that's going to be a first step in getting the resources to people, is identifying them. And that, I would imagine, is a tremendous barrier here, because, you know, I mean, this is a big city with world-class facilities, and if it's hard to find proper counseling here, just imagine the poor family in Topeka, Kansas, or wherever. I mean, it just must be a really uphill battle. So that's the sort of thing that governments and the internet can help solve. And I would urge that, you know, as you continue to communicate with our staff, if there are such lists of resources, those are things that should be passed along.
I'd be happy to put one together.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Our next speaker and our last program speaker is Joy O'Donnell.
Good evening. Thank you for the opportunity for me to be here to speak to you tonight at this historic meeting. My name is Joy O'Donnell, and I am the Director of Training for the National Sexuality Resource Center, a new project of the 30-year-old Human Sexuality Studies program at San Francisco State University. The mission of our organization is to create new dialogues between the public, researchers, and community advocates to strengthen informed responses to critical sexual and social issues. Our training program seeks to educate and train graduate and postgraduate students from interdisciplinary backgrounds, as well as professionals from such fields as medicine, law, teaching, counseling, social work, religion, and advocacy. Our desire is to provide the latest cutting-edge sexuality research and disseminate it to as many professionals as possible so that they may improve their understanding of sexuality in order to more effectively perform their work. Each summer, we provide a 4-week training for academics and professionals from all around the United States and internationally. The Summer Institute is one of the only continuing education training grounds for sexuality aimed toward professionals held anywhere in the United States. During the 2003 Summer Institute, I hired the Intersex Society of North America to provide a 2-hour lecture on intersex issues to our student population of medical students and doctors, nurse practitioners, social workers, teachers, public health officials, therapists, sex educators, and researchers. Many of our faculty, some of them top experts in sexuality research from all around the world, were also in attendance. A clear indication that even the most seasoned within the field knew little about the subject and were desperate for information and training themselves. I am here to report to you that we were all collectively floored, completely floored, and seriously disturbed and moved to action by what we learned in that very brief slice of time. I had no idea that the intersex lecture would produce such a strong reaction in all of our students and faculty. Discussion following the presentation surrounded our outrage that most of us knew little or nothing of the large-scale negative impact of these genital reassignment surgeries on infants. Medical students and doctors in particular felt alienated by the fact that they had not learned anything about these serious issues within their education. The lack of inclusion of intersex issues within sexuality education in this country is highlighted by the reaction to this lecture. Very, very few people even know what intersex means, much less anything about the abuses sustained by these injuries and surgeries. Summer Institute exit evaluations last year showed a high degree of desire to learn more about intersex issues by both professional and academic students. The majority of students listed the intersex workshop as one of the most important and influential aspects of their entire experience, writing repeatedly that it was one of the most helpful and useful trainings they had ever attended. In addition, 44% of all of our attendees reported that they hoped we would require intersex training in future educational sessions, especially for professionals who were in the position to go back to their work and make change around the issue. One student wrote the following about what the intersex training taught them. Besides the emotional trauma and mutilation to these individuals, I learned that there is such thing as medical rape, which goes tolerated and unpunished. This quote was particularly striking to me because it mentions punishment. Students repeatedly mentioned that individual lack of empowerment on the part of the children and their parents and autonomy to make decisions about their own bodies was similar to rape and therefore punishable legally. The lack of proper training in intersex issues is extremely severe in the U.S. today, and this lack of inclusion within sex education allows for the continued acceptance of these surgeries on the part of many who just do not have the proper information to understand the negative effects. In my position as Director of Training for the San Francisco State National Sexuality Resource Center, I urgently recommend that the City of San Francisco seriously consider immediately halting these surgeries. The greatest majority of individuals who have had them have lived painful and difficult lives, as we have learned tonight. But these individuals and their parents and loved ones are not the only ones who are suffering. Those medical professionals who assist with the vicious act, many of them not understanding the tragic results of their work, suffer too when they discover and acknowledge the harms of it, as happened last summer in our training. Ultimately, we all suffer by living in a society that condones stealing the selfhood of individuals at such young ages by inflicting upon them society's notions of what is proper. I would also like to urgently recommend that medical professionals and medical students, especially within the city of San Francisco, be required to take courses on intersex issues from a social and psychological perspective before they are allowed to practice. Intersex training should also be weaved into as many city-sponsored parent education classes as possible so that parents understand the impact of potential decisions they might have to make. Proper education on these matters will undoubtedly work toward breaking the silence and paving a way for healing and proper care of these individuals and their loved ones. Intersexed individuals need to have the right to decide for themselves what to do with their bodies. This is a blatant human rights abuse issue and constitutes a serious crisis requiring action. Please address it with vigor. San Francisco is too great a city to allow this and can, as it has in so many other ways, set a powerful precedent in so doing. And I would just like to end by saying that as part of the Human Sexuality Studies program at San Francisco State, what we're developing is a adult education certificate program that we will be marketing to professionals such as medical doctors, as well as parents, teachers, counselors. And we're developing what we think right now may be one of the first semester-long intersex issues courses. And we're hoping to have that up and running in the fall of 2005. Thank you so much for your time.
And thank you. And I'll repeat that just in case you didn't hear it. You see a few of the commissioners leaving. Commissioner Patton, for example, has a youth commission board meeting that she has to go to. And normally our hearings don't run this long, so this is a bit of the scheduling issue. But I just wanted to let you know that obviously all of the testimony is being recorded. It all will be referred back to the advisory committee and the task force, so it's not as if this is going in vain. The other thing that some people may be worried about is a quorum requirement. We do not have an action item on the agenda tonight, so there will not be any votes. So the lack of a quorum, which we now
are lacking is not technically a problem. This is a discussion item hearing, and, you know, the city attorney is not here, but I know if she was, she'd tell me I'm not acting improperly by continuing the meeting without a quorum, and even if she said that, I don't know what I'd do. But anyways, don't tell Kathy I said that, please. So just so you all know, as a matter of process, what's going on. Thank you to our speakers on the program. I have several yellow cards for public comment on this item, which is the intersex hearing. Not to be rude, but we will limit these comments to 2 minutes of pop, which is within my discretion. And so I ask you to focus on saying things, either reiterating very tersely what's been said or focusing on new things that you think the commission and its staff would benefit from. First card I have is Kathleen Unger, Dr. Unger, excuse me. She left. Well, see, if you run the hearing long enough, sometimes you wait people out. Jimmy Bruce. All right. Thank you for sticking around, Jimmy.
So I'm one of those walking experiments Dr. O'Hanlon spoke of. 2 minutes, eh? I was born in 1976 in a South Louisiana hospital. I came with a phallus, undescended testes, and a karyotype of XY. After some deliberation, it was decided by the pediatrician, urologist, and my father that rather than raise me as a little boy with a shorter than typical phallus, they decided, in effect, to start over, to erase what was there between my legs and begin anew. They made me a girl. The urologist excised my phallus completely and removed my undescended testicles. A scalpel was used to cut and discard perfectly healthy tissue. My parents were then counseled not by a psychologist or a therapist, but a surgeon about the next step. Reinforce the gender assignment. Conceal much, reveal little. When I was 12 years old, one day I was watching a baseball game on TV, Cubs versus Dodgers. My mother was sobbing on the phone to someone. After she hung up, she called me into the kitchen and told me 4 things. 1, that I was born hermaphrodite. 2, that I would soon have to start taking pills. I later found out these were estrogen pills, Premarin, pregnant Mary urine. 3, that I would have to have a surgery soon to finish me as a woman. And 4, that I would never be able to birth children. The not having children part was what really made her break down. I comforted my mother and told her it was okay. Lying by omission is what it's called, and the heart of the matter is self-determination. No one told me that I was what I was born with, only what they were giving me now. 10 days after I turned 18, I was home from school for Christmas break at Children's Hospital in New Orleans. It was there that I received my colon vaginoplasty, my $20,000 vaginal canal that was essentially free of charge because my parents' insurance company agreed with the surgeon that this procedure was absolutely necessary. This procedure was inflicted upon me without my educated and or informed consent. And with zero discussion, they sent me back to school. At the age of 19, I was fortunate enough to come across an essay written by Suzanne Kessler on baby hermaphrodites in America. Her writing was the impetus I clearly needed to retrieve my medical records. I got them, read them, and I was devastated. I then began to fight wars against my parents for months. They were cowering. They had no idea what to do. 2 years later, I moved to California for the purpose of telling anyone and everyone how pissed off to hell I was at the way I was manipulated and abused and the way my intersex sisters and brothers were manipulated and abused. And 6 years later, I am still dealing with all of the consequences of the choices made on my behalf strictly out of fear, minimal sexual function, depression, severe osteoporosis, and the like. The operative word is moratorium. It should be placed, at the very least, on surgeries in San Francisco. It's a great place to start, and you guys can do that. Thank you.
Very much. Next card I have is from Peter Tanner. Next card I have is from Katrina Karkazis. Ah, I missed one. It's going so well, too.
Thank you for staying so late and giving me a moment to speak.
Good evening.
I am in the Department of Biomedical Ethics at Stanford University. My doctorate is in cultural and medical anthropology, and I also have a master's in public health. The research that's occupied me for really since 1997 has been discussing recent debates over the medical management, if you will, of intersex infants. So in a really quick nutshell, what I did was to interview 20 clinicians around the country, pediatric urologists and endocrinologists, to interview intersex adults and to interview parents of intersex infants and intersex adults. I don't have a lot of time. What I'd like to do very quickly is address a question that arose very early on tonight that really was prompted by Larry Baskin's comment and your question about sort of how pervasive is this. I interviewed surgeons and endocrinologists in Chicago, in Dartmouth, at Brown, Harvard, Columbia, UCSF, Stanford, basically large portions of the country. These clinicians spoke to me privately and said these surgeries are continuing. They're being done earlier in life than what was ever initially listed in protocol, often within the first few weeks of life. Parents are not given proper informed consent. They're not told about outcomes, complications, advocacy groups, or the idea that there might be necessary repeat surgeries later in life. Parents are pressured to have surgery when they initially refuse it. This comes as well from the parents that I interviewed. Please understand this data is being pulled from a lot of different sources, including medical meetings. Parents oftentimes might consent to one surgery, not knowing that others will be performed. What I think that the people have argued tonight is that what these debates are really about is who has the power and authority to define and determine embodied experience. And my argument would be that this is not a medical issue, it's a cultural issue, and that these decisions rest with the individuals on whom they so heavily impact. Thank you.
You said you spoke with doctors privately, which suggests to me that you're getting a different response privately than you might get publicly, that
That's
there's
exactly
a lot of pressure to follow a protocol.
Right.
I'm still having trouble grasping why a doctor would deviate from a protocol that would publicly bring them scorn or at least, you know, some problem. Why would a doctor perform a procedure or know about a procedure in his or her facility that he or she is not happy to talk about? I mean, we all do things that we're ashamed of, and we try. But
right.
What I'm getting at is, if the doctors know they should be ashamed of this, why do they allow it to go on?
I think it's much more complicated. I don't think that every doctor feels shame. I think if they did, they probably wouldn't be doing it. To give you one anecdote, which I think is emblematic, this is a highly subjective experience. When someone looks at ambiguous genitals, what my research shows, there's not often measurement involved. It's an eye judgment. Is it too big to remain on this female infant? Is it too small to remain on this male infant? They said that repeatedly, and they don't measure. So it's a subjective criterion. What comes at the next level is, what does that mean exactly?
But before we go past that, whether there's surgery or not is an objective question. And what Dr. Baskin was suggesting, that surgery at UCSF is very rare.
Right.
Are you suggesting to me that in your interviews you have found that people tell you privately that surgeries are not rare at UCSF?
I can't get into a, you know, exactly what's happening at UCSF. What I would say is, around the country, he made the illusion that somehow what was happening at UCSF, which if that is really what is happening, that I would be greatly pleased, is somehow also happening among all of his colleagues.
Right. Well, that's the question I asked.
No.
And your answer is, no, it's not.
I had top surgeons, because you have to understand, too, many of these infants get referred to top centers as well. So there is some locus about where these surgeries happen. The top surgeons at these institutions told me, in no uncertain terms, that the surgeries are still continuing.
And
they had examples from...
How recent were these interviews?
These interviews were done in 2000 and 2001. And so in that sense, there's been a public move, I think, to begin to question. But that doesn't mean that surgeries stop. So in some cases, parents are pressing for surgery.
Sure.
because they're terrified.
Sure.
So that needs to be taken into account. Some parents will shop around to find a surgeon who will do it. There's not just one specialty doing this. Right? There are any number of surgical specialties that perform these surgeries with, you know, more experience, less experience. I would argue, though, that data collection in many ways is not the answer. We will never get a good answer about surgical results, and in a nutshell, this is the reason why. If we do surgery on an infant, the ideal evaluative component of that surgery would be to talk to that person as an adult when they are a sexual being and are able to understand questions of identity, sexuality, and sexual experience. Because there's this argument that surgical technique changes so rapidly, what you all often hear doctors say is that, well, we don't do that anymore. Well, the problem is that evaluative studies will always lag behind surgical techniques so that we can never correctly evaluate. And then what would happen potentially is that we'd want to really pay attention to what the criteria are for evaluation. Does that include, because I forget who it was, Kate O'Hanlon, someone else really pointed out, these are peer-reviewed. So what happens is that surgeons, in many cases, evaluate their own surgical work. In these cases where there are 5 or 10 people, they're evaluating a technique they did. They're doing it in infancy before the child is an adult, and there's no subjective component of the individual who underwent or was subjected to the surgery. So I don't think in many ways that data collection on surgery, one, I don't think it's possible, and many groups, NAPFI, which was talked about earlier, the task force, it's not going to be possible. It's the wrong answer. Really. The question is not, can we do surgery correctly? There will always be problems. Once you cut tissue, there's nerve damage. It may regenerate. There will always be nerve damage. There will always be scarred tissue that covers over that's thickened, that's more insensitive than any tissue you would originally have as a human being. So I don't think that's the right answer. I think the right answer is to say, is this a medical issue or is it a cultural issue? And if it's not a medical issue, then we need to deal with the cultural ideas that make this somehow seem medically imperative when it's not. This has not always been the purview of clinicians. And what that says to me is that it needn't be now.
Okay, so. Thank you. Again, I want to thank you and all the speakers for all the valuable information that you brought to us. And I just want to inquire, I believe that the record on this hearing, will it remain open? Because for a situation like this where we have someone who's done concerted research and yet you're relegated to 3 minutes after being very patient, or 2 minutes after being very patient all evening, if I would think that if there's anything you want to contribute going forward, we would welcome that and certainly integrate it in as part of the final report, although that's probably something that Malcolm or someone else was going to say at the end of the meeting. But, again, thank you, and, you know, it's a...
Right.
You know,
well, and I would point out as well, I mean, since you're just down on the farm right here, you can always, you know, talk to Marcus or leave his information so that you can continue to communicate with the task force.
Just to let the commissioners know, we have received and expect to receive more written testimony from people who also gave oral testimony, so they can give longer comments in their written testimony.
And down on the farm, folks, means at Stanford. I realize that after I said that.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mary McGee.
Thank you, Commissioners. My name is Mary McGee, and I am a nurse at San Francisco General, where I've worked as a labor and delivery nurse, postpartum nurse, for 12 years. And the irony of following the previous speakers is that I stand in front of you as probably one of the most inexpert people in the room on this important issue. As I said, I've been a labor and delivery room nurse for 12 years in probably the most progressive public health hospital in the nation, in the most progressive city in the nation, and I have never received any training on this issue ever. Now, I am the person in the room who is most likely to lift the baby up off the baby's mama's chest to take a little peek to make the grand announcement of it's a girl, it's a boy, and then I proceed to write it probably 15 places in the chart. And yet I have no training on these issues, particularly around sensitivity and helping people hook up with resources, helping parents absorb the news that perhaps it's not clear right now what the gender of the baby is. I have a lot of faith in the social workers that work at San Francisco General and their ability to obtain resources. Whether they have resources on intersex issues readily at their hands, I can't say. They have access to internet, but I can tell you that most of the parents I work with do not. These are working poor people, and many of them do not have a computer. So it just brings to home what people have been saying about how there really have to be resources readily available, someone who can come right in and be with the parents. So I ask you to please, in your recommendations, urge for there to be legislative response, recommendations that intersex issues be dealt with in the curricula of social work programs, nursing programs, medical school, psychology, continuing ed programs for people who've been nurses for 20 years like myself and certainly never heard anything about intersex issues in nursing school. And thank you. It's very much an honor to be in this room with incredible people. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Sean Safa Wall.
It's Sean Safa Wall.
Sorry.
I'm fortunate to stand before you and speak about intersex issues. I know I only speak for myself, but for my two uncles who also live with partial androgen insensitivity syndrome. I speak for them because their scars are deep and so painful that they can't even mouth the word intersex. I speak for my cousins and my sisters who, at the onset of a discussion about PAIS, cringe, especially because my third to oldest sister was rejected from the ROTC because of testicular feminization syndrome, a former name for PAIS. I speak as one of many intersex people of color in this world who may not have access to email, listservs, and resources to acknowledge and embrace their intersex condition. I speak for my mom, mother of three children with PAIS, and sister to two brothers with AIS, who carries guilt and fear of people discovering her children's and brothers' intersex conditions and treating them unfairly. Although I have not had genital surgeries, I do carry the scars of a bilateral gonadectomy, which removed my undescended testes at the age of 13. I do relate to years of estrogen therapy and prodding by psychotherapists who wanted to know if the estrogen altered my attraction to women or changed my presentation as male. I can relate to interns and doctors inspecting my genitals and gynecologists shoving their finger in my anus searching for a scrotum but not telling me anything. I advocate for letting intersex infants develop with the help of their own gonads before administering hormones. As a commission that can influence policy and education, I hope that you can increase awareness of intersex people. As a community organizer with the Gay Straight Alliance Network, I am hoping to design trainings that increase awareness of intersex people. I believe that one avenue of intersex awareness can be in middle and high school health classes that reinforce the male and female binary model. In closing, I ask people to redefine what is normal when thinking about male and female. I also ask people to reflect on how many people are alienated because their lives and experiences fall outside of our established binary system. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Morningstar Vansel.
Hi. I'm not an intersex, but I've been to female circumcision. Intersex is important to me because it explains the things that I've been through. I was diagnosed with cancer last year, with uterus cancer, and my doctor took a look at my body and asked me in person, she happened to be a Korean woman from another country, who asked me if I have female circumcision. And nobody knew that. And I told her yes. And I have told my partner that I had female circumcision. And those are the things that I have kept to myself. Right now, I'm doing a research about women from the third world country who have female circumcision who had cancer. And I have met some women who told me that they had cancer, like such as ovarian cancer. When I was younger, I had a lot of yeast infection, a lot of infection, because the female circumcision was done not sanitized and all that stuff. So when the only thing I need to put it out there is people who are intersex, who had reassigned surgery, how many of us, you know, people, because I asked other people if they had cancer, if they got infected, and there's some few people that I have talked to who got infected by it. That's all I need to say. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. That concludes public comment on the intersex hearing and concludes the agenda item. We have a few other things to go over, but thank you very much for everybody who participated in this portion of our hearing tonight. And I just want to reiterate, as Commissioner Grigg anticipated that I would say, this is just the beginning of an important discussion. We've had some experts here. We've had some members of the activist community. We've had a lot of people who we hope to be able to call on again as Marcus and his task force figure out, you know, what are the issues we as a commission are going to focus on, what action are we going to take, and what action are we going to urge others to take. It's a long process. This is not one of these things where we produce a result in one night, and I think everybody understands that. But at the same time, as I've said before, one of the things I've learned to appreciate about this commission and about city government in particular is that process is helpful, and it's nice when people can come down and educate others and get things off their chest and work through these matters. So I appreciate everyone's time tonight. Some of these issues are very personal, very passionate, and this hearing was conducted with a great deal of decorum and respect for everybody, and I appreciate that. So thank you, everybody, on the intersex hearing. Moving on to items that are not to do with this hearing, let me just say something that I was remiss in not pointing out earlier. June, of course, is Pride Month, and KQED and Kaiser Permanente are honoring this Pride Month by honoring six outstanding local heroes, two of whom are our own Larry Brinken and Cynthia Goldstein, who are sitting there. They will be honored at the KQED Center on June 11th. Space is limited, so RSVP now. A notice will go around to commissioners, and the ultimate sign that really you have arrived in San Francisco, this invitation says complimentary valet parking. Wow. That is some kind of honor. That's like San Francisco red carpet right there. So congratulations to you two. I will be there. And I hope other commissioners can join. Finally, we have public comment on matters not on the agenda. I have four cards. Again, this commission meeting has run long, and unfortunately we don't have a quorum anymore, but we can hear public comment, and I would urge those of public comment to be brief. First is Johnny Willis. Johnny Willis, once, twice, sold to the lady in the pink hat. Maurice Paul Jerome. Floyd Band and Tyrone Kelly. All right. Well, hopefully those people will return in another meeting to provide their public comment. That is it. Marcus, congratulations. Job well done. Thank you, everybody, for coming. Meeting is adjourned. Thank you.